You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Scott Ritter. Scott Ritter is a former Marine Corps intelligence officer who worked in the former Soviet Union implementing arms control treaties in the Persian Gulf during Operation Desert Storm and in Iraq overseeing the disarmament of WMD. He is the author of Deal of the Century, How Iran Blocked the West's Road to War. And he recently published an article in the American Conservative called Trump's Rush to Judgment on Syria Chemical Attack. Scott Ritter, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We have just seen a bombing campaign launched just prior to some inspectors completing their work. Does this remind you of anything?
Well, it's part of a pattern of the United States and its allies using weapons of mass destruction as an excuse to, implement a larger policy. I think one of the things to differentiate what occurred in Syria recently with, for instance, what occurred in Iraq, is that there doesn't seem to be a coherent policy that's being sought in Syria. We bombed Syria to what end? To what objective? Unlike Iraq, where we had this massive war plan in place and a strategy of regime change, while there might be some people within the Trump administration who articulate a desire to see Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, removed from power, there is no means being put in place to achieve this. The United States under President Trump, and indeed under President Obama before him, seem to have accepted the unpleasant reality that Bashar al-Assad, assisted by the Russian Federation, by the Islamic Republic of Iran, and by Lebanese Hezbollah, has not only solidified his hold on power, but in fact will probably prevail in the civil war that's been raging in Syria since 2012.
It seems like up until about 2013, the policy was pretty openly overthrowing the government, and people like John McCain were even saying this will be a step to overthrowing Iran's government. And then when the public really pushed back against an escalation by Barack Obama in 2013 and went quite acceptingly along with an escalation the next year when it was all about ISIS videos and the United States sort of got into the war on both sides of the same war. It seems like from that point forward, it's been this sort of more confusing picture of which side of the war are you on? Am I right that it's because the public was so resistant to another overthrow and so accepting of do anything you want, these videos of ISIS are so scary?
Well, I think you're hitting the nail on the head when you talk about the confused status of the American public. I respect every American citizen's inherent right to hold an opinion. That's one of the beauties of the democracy that we have. But it is critical for this democracy to function effectively that the opinion be an informed opinion, an informed opinion based upon facts, not fiction or fantasy. The average American doesn't know a damn thing, excuse my language, about Syria. It doesn't know anything about ISIS. It doesn't know how ISIS was formed. It doesn't know about the roots of ISIS. It doesn't know how ISIS spread. It doesn't know anything about the regime of Bashar al-Assad. It doesn't know, anything about Lebanese Hezbollah. It doesn't know anything about the Islamic Republic of Iran. It doesn't know anything about Russia and why Russia would want to intervene in 2015. The American public swims in a sea of ignorance and therefore is easily manipulated. One of the factors of manipulation is in many ways a good one, that in the aftermath of the decision to invade and occupy Iraq by the administration of George W. Bush back in 2003, I think many Americans have woken up to the harsh reality of what happens when you overthrow a dictator who's held power in a given piece of territory for decades, and you don't have a plan of what to do when he's gone, how to replace him. And so they were inherently resistant to the notion of yet another regime change in a neighboring nation that looked an awful lot like the one we just toppled, and said, no, we don't want to do this again. But on the other hand, we live in this era of American exceptionalism where we have, the highest level of moral authority in the world, and therefore when some idiot Islamist fundamentalist with a hood over his head takes a knife and saws off the head of a hostage, we feel like we have an inherent duty and responsibility and obligation to do something about this. My God, this is horrible. Well, on both sides, we've been manipulated. We've been manipulated by an incomplete story. On the one hand, we achieve a result that some, including myself, would say is good. We didn't go into Syria. On the other hand, we are easily manipulated into going in to defeat ISIS. On both occasions, we have American policy being driven by emotion as opposed to hard fact, hard analysis, sound thinking.
Yeah. So what are the facts, if any? What's your assessment of these accusations of somebody having killed people in the wrong way, that is, with chemical weapons rather than some other kind of weapons?
Well, we have to start off with a foundation of fact. Fact A, Syria had these weapons. There's no doubt about it. Syria doesn't deny it. Fact B, Syria signed the Chemical Weapons Convention. Fact C, Russia agreed to be the guarantor of Syrian compliance with the Chemical Weapons Convention. Fact D, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which is the UN-sponsored organization that that oversees the implementation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, went into Syria and oversaw the complete destruction, certified, and I want to emphasize that word, certified the complete elimination of Syria's chemical weapons program. That includes the weapons themselves, the storage facilities, the loading facilities, the means of production, everything certified as being eliminated. Now, there's a little caveat put into that, because at the time that the OPCW was carrying out its inspections inside Syria, Syria was wrapped up in this ongoing civil war, and there were large swaths of Syrian territory, including parts of the territory that contained parts of the chemical weapons capacity of the Syrian government that weren't under the control of the Syrian government. They were under control of rebels, and there are numerous accounts of how the rebels gained access to certain features of the Syrian chemical weapons capability, including the probability that they got their hands on the precursor chemicals that are used to make sarin. Again, we can't prove this beyond a shadow of a doubt, but there's a level of uncertainty there that some precursor elements of sarin nerve agent may have fallen into the control of the rebel forces. But in terms of the Syrian government's possession of this, the OPCW certified it. This means after a process of verification, certified that these weapons had been eliminated. So we have a problem here where we have a fact-based narrative that starts with the Syrian government having been certified of being rid of all of its weapons, chemical weapons, and the probability that elements of the anti-regime forces got their hands on at least the precursor chemicals related to sarin nerve agent. Now we move forward where there seems to be a series of events that take place where at a critical time, chemical agent is used, not in a military fashion, by the way. I mean, if you look at every single one of the accusations that's been placed out there about the use of chemical weapons, they've never been used at a critical time and place to achieve a battlefield result. In fact, they've been used almost 100% of the time at a time and place when the Syrian army is gaining superiority on the battlefield, about to achieve a major breakthrough. Something, you know, momentous is happening where the tide of fortune is shifting away from the rebels toward the Syrian army, and then, boom, out of nowhere, a militarily useless, a militarily meaningless event is alleged to have occurred that involves either sarin nerve agent or chlorine gas. Now, chlorine gas is not a listed chemical for the Chemical Weapons Convention, and Syria is awash in it, as is every nation that has a modern water purification system. You bring in these 150-pound cylinders of chlorine gas. You hook them up to a system that purifies water. Syria has lots of these, and these canisters have suddenly appeared on the battlefield to employ chlorine gas. But again, they weren't done in a militarily meaningful fashion. They were done in small quantities, and they tended to exclusively hit civilians, or in some cases, Syrian army soldiers, when there's no doubt that the other side, the rebel side, used it.
Yeah.
The United States and others who have a tendency to be in opposition to the Syrian government have latched on to these allegations of chemical weapons use to point an accusatory finger at the Syrian government, to use this as a means of saying this government can't be trusted. This government is in violation of international law. This government is in violation of its commitments under the Chemical Weapons Convention. This seems to be what's happening here. There's no evidence whatsoever that's been presented to prove that the Syrian government has done anything in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. You do have various United Nations and OPCW reports which point the finger toward the Syrian government. There was let's back up for a second. The OPCW, the inspectors for the OPCW, by their very mandate, can't say Party A or Party B did something. Their mandate allows them to say something occurred that involved chemicals that are prohibited under the Chemical Weapons Convention, and they can provide a fact-based narrative of what occurred, but they're not allowed to say who done it. Unique to Syria, something called the Joint Investigative Mechanism was formed under the authority of the Security Council that worked in conjunction with the OPCW to investigate certain events that took place. And this Joint Investigative Mechanism was mandated to say who did it. And on numerous occasions, the conclusion of their report was that the Syrian government did it. And the United States and others have jumped on this to say, this is the proof we need. But when you deconstruct every single Joint Investigative Mechanism report, you find flawed technique, you find flawed analysis, you find a process that has been heavily politicized by the Americans, by the British, by the French, to produce an outcome that is, that is an anti-Syrian regime. This is one of the reasons why the Russians finally vetoed the extension of the Joint Investigative Mechanism and said, we no longer trust this mechanism. Anybody who takes a fact-based, nonpartisan look at the reports of the Joint Investigative Mechanism will find that they are fundamentally flawed reports that have been politicized to achieve an outcome that will be used by certain members of the Security Council, namely the United States, for political purposes, namely to accuse the Syrian government of using these chemical weapons. That's what we find today. Last year at this time, there was Khan Shaykhun was accused of being attacked by a sarin chlorine nerve agent. The Joint Investigative Mechanism, together with the OPCW, reached the conclusion that the Syrian government was responsible. And yet, not one inspector visited the site that was attacked. Not one inspector visited the airfield that was bombed by the United States, because we said that's where they handled the weapons, they used the weapons. Nobody inspected that to say, here's the evidence that weapons were handled here. You would have found it had you gone there. What they did rely on, though, were samples collected by the rebel forces in almost a Keystone Cop fashion, wearing hazardous materials protective suits as if there's something dangerous at place, but they're training suits. They clearly say training on them. So it was a show. It was a farce. It was an act of theater.
Right.
You can't trust that outcome, and yet now we have a situation in Douma where, once again, the very same rebels who were responsible for the fraud last year are presenting video images and such of an event, and this prompted the United States, France, and Great Britain to take action. And yet when you deconstruct this, you find that nothing happened in Douma, that this is all a farce, this is all theater. And I hope that this time the difference will be that the OPCW, when they go into Douma, is going to find no evidence whatsoever of a chemical attack. Now, the United States and France and Great Britain have already set the stage for this probable outcome by saying, well, it's clear that the Russians and the Syrians have cleansed the site. So they're already creating, you know, the conditions for uncertainty to be injected into what will probably be an absolute negative result by the OPCW. And this tragic farce will continue.
We're speaking with Scott Ritter. Scott, this is incredibly useful and valuable. I want to raise a little bit different question, however. The line at the top of your recent article said, "We need hard evidence of what happened in Douma before threatening war." And my question is, what hard evidence, even if it were all solidly proven to everyone's satisfaction, could possibly justify threatening war? And isn't threatening war and also waging war illegal under, among other things, the United Nations Charter?
Well, first of all, the United Nations Charter doesn't make war illegal. It makes wars of aggression illegal. There is a process that can be used to justify a military response. But that process implies that a process actually takes place. For instance, under the Chemical Weapons Convention, a signatory party accused of using chemical weapons, there will be an investigation by the OPCW. If they find that chemical weapons were used, then there's a whole process under the Chemical Weapons Convention where the parties seek to resolve the issue. If that issue cannot be resolved, it would then be brought forward to the Security Council, where the Security Council would seek to go through a series of measures, invoking various resolutions, short of a Chapter 7 resolution authorizing use of force, in an effort to remedy the situation. Only if all these processes has failed and the party, the accused party, continues to operate in a manner which is deemed to threaten international peace and security by the Security Council, would a Chapter 7 resolution authorizing the use of military force be authorized. This did not happen. What we have is the United States going to the Security Council, Ambassador Nikki Haley saying, if you don't automatically agree with us that there's a problem in Syria worthy of military force, then you are no good, you are useless to us, and we will act alone. And, of course, the Security Council did not agree. Russia vetoed their efforts, and the United States acted in violation of international law. This is what people need to understand, that what we did on Saturday in attacking Syria, it violates international law and, frankly speaking, violates American law. I mean, where's congressional action? How does this fit into the authorization for the use of military force? The authorization for use of military force that currently exists allows military power to be used in fighting terrorist organizations, non-state entities who are operating on a global basis to harm the United States. Even if Syria did do what they were accused of doing in Douma, how does that harm the United States? How does that authorize the use of military force under current congressional authorities? Congress was never consulted on this attack. Congress has never given a chance to weigh in. And ultimately, no evidence was provided that sustained the arguments put forward by the Trump administration. So,
right.
There is a process where war can occur. That process did not happen.
Right, but even accepting that for the sake of argument, the violation of the UN Charter, the absence of any UN Security Council authorization and so forth would remain the case even if Congress had been consulted and Congress had formally declared war on Syria. That wouldn't legalize it under the United Nations.
Right, but now we come to the hard truth. The United States, international law does not apply to the United States. We've made that just as plain and simple and true as it can be. The United States, as it's currently configured, will never accept any submission of its sovereignty to an international organization, and this includes the United Nations Security Council. This is sad truth. Now we're entering into fantasy land the second we think that the United States will abide by international law when it's inconvenient. I think the most important thing here is that the United States doesn't even have internal checks and balances halting the rush to war. I mean, you know, to talk about Article 51 is a joke because the United States, with its veto, will never be held accountable by the United Nations or by the international community. But when we speak about American democracy and the checks and balances that are supposed to come into play, the fact that Congress has 100% abrogated any authority or responsibility for the conduct of military operations to an executive who appears to be able to launch missiles void of any evidence, missiles out on a whim. And for all those chest-thumping Americans out there who think it's great to go out and wage this global war on terror, you know, remember, we launched missiles based upon falsified evidence presented by a Saudi-funded, Saudi-backed Islamic fundamentalist group who beheads women and children on a regular basis, who is allied with al-Nusra and al-Qaeda, the same people who attacked us on 9/11, if you buy into that narrative. But the point is, you know, who are we fighting for when we launch these missiles? This was an active theater designed to lift an American president's public standing at a time when he was being attacked on the domestic political front. This was about anything other than a threat to the United States.
Scott Ritter, several months back, Colleen Rowley, a friend of mine, sent me another great article you'd written. It was from Truth Dig, and it was replying to an article about so-called ethical wars by Pete Kilner, who now teaches ethics at West Point. And I contacted Kilner because I'm always trying to get someone to debate me on whether a just war is possible. And so he and I did two public debates, and in my humble opinion, he lost both of them. Can you comment on this notion of these wars being done ethically? He includes, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan and other recent wars among the just and ethically waged wars of the United States.
Well, you know, this is a tough one because I spent a considerable amount of time in the Marine Corps and I was prepared and am currently prepared to act in a military fashion to defend my country and defend, you know, and that includes not just in defense of an invasion of my country, but to defend the interests of my country abroad. So I'm not a pacifist. I don't buy into pacifism, and I hope I'm not insulting anybody in your audience or you.
We will agree to disagree as we've got
But the one thing I've learned in learning to not just learning to fight a war, but in actually fighting a war, is there's no such thing as an ethical war. I mean, let's just stop that nonsense at the, you know, right off the bat. War is about killing, plain and simple. And if you're a Christian, if you're not a Christian, but if you're somebody who believes in the sanctity of human life, you are ethically wrong if you say war can be fought in an ethical fashion. First of all, the people you're killing have nothing to do, for the most part, with that which you claim to be fighting for. Every Iraqi that died because of my actions had nothing to do with the regime of Saddam Hussein. Nothing whatsoever. Most of them died because of bombings that took place on territory that we assessed as being related to some greater evil. And all it was related to was the day-to-day life of an Iraqi civilian who ended up perishing because some idiot in the headquarters put a designation on a point on a map and somebody dropped a bomb on that. How is that ethical? There's nothing ethical about this. Now, we can make an argument about just wars. But again, if we're going to say that we are a people who believe in the rule of law, and we have signed on to certain legal frameworks that require due process, then the only just war is that war which follows and exhausts those legal processes to prevent war before we engage in war. But even if you do that, you can't have an ethical war. Now, we can talk about limiting the damage to civilians. But, you know, I've read the Geneva Convention. I've read over and over again about how the United States, we can accept collateral damage in the conduct of a legitimate military, an operation that has legitimate military objectives. Well, my God, you know, being a writer, being somebody creative, I can come up with a legitimate military objective, or i.e. excuse, for any number of deaths. For instance, we're allowed to drop an atomic bomb on a city. Is that ethical? We just annihilated tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people to achieve a military objective? No, there's nothing ethical about war. And anybody who claims that war can be fought on an ethical basis is simply providing an excuse or cover for the horror of war that should be enough to get any sane thinking person to say, we can never go down this path. And that's my goal and objective as somebody who isn't a pacifist, who, you know, has fought in a war and is prepared to do it again. I keep telling people the last thing on the planet you want to do is go to war. And I beg you, I plead with you to do everything possible short of war to make sure that we don't head down that path, because once you turn on that switch, you can't control it. And people are going to die, innocent people. They're going to die by the bushel full, and there's nothing ethical about that. And anybody who tries to paint what we do in a time of war with an ethical brush is delusional.
Scott Ritter, less than a minute left. It seems you're three quarters of the way toward agreeing with me, someone who wants to get rid of war entirely. Would a first step perhaps be to spend something less than $1 trillion a year getting ready for more wars?
Look, if you buy it, you're going to use it. That's just the way it goes. So if we're going to spend $700+ billion on a military machine, eventually we're going to succumb to the temptation to use it, whether it's a president who wants to send new shiny missiles towards an empty building in Syria, or Madeleine Albright and others chastising Colin Powell that we have this great military. Why are we afraid to use it? The bottom line is we create something that's going to be used. And the other problem with spending that much money is we create something that can be used in any situation. As opposed to creating a defense force, we create a force that can be used at any time to replace a deficit, for instance, in diplomatic action. I'm a huge believer in diplomacy.
I wish we could go on. We're sadly out of time. Scott Ritter, former weapons inspector, will have links to his articles and books on TalkNationRadio.org. Thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at RootsAction.org. Help end war at WorldBeyondWar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the United States military is, at any given moment, visiting lethal violence on human beings with families and hopes and dreams in a range of countries around the world. Media coverage is a sort of roving spotlight, highlighting one or another of those nightmares and enjoining the U.S. public to care about it for a minute and in a particular way, even if they haven't heard much about it until now and might stop hearing about it next week. That coverage, while it might be full of narrative detail, is generally crude in its message. There are good guys. Hint, that's always going to be the United States. And bad guys. Those will be whomever the article tells you they are, even if they just got through presenting those bad guys as good guys in another context. And there's an implied, encouraged response, which virtually always involves dropping bombs and virtually never involves ascertaining what regular people say they want and need to live in peace. So, as corporate media talk about Syria, where a recent airstrike by the U.S., legality be damned, is meant to represent the U.S. doing the right thing in the world, you are right to ask questions. What is actually happening in Syria? Do the people there welcome intervention by the U.S., Russia, or anyone? Are the principles supposedly guiding U.S. intervention in Syria really principles in the sense of being universally applied? And if not, why are they being invoked now? Americans can be forgiven for not knowing what's going on in every other country, but they're also right to ask whether media demanding that the country's president order devastation on another country's people are actually informing them or just doing state PR. We'll talk about U.S. military intervention in Syria with Gregory Shupak. He teaches media studies at the University of Guelph-Humber in Toronto, and he's author of the new book, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. That's coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you by the Media Watch Group FAIR. Talking about Syria, it seems, is not so much having a conversation as occupying a narrative. Either Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, is the sole source of Syria's pain. Those who oppose him represent the true will of the Syrian people, and critical outsiders are benighted. Or Assad, though flawed, represents the people's will. The rebels are, if anything, more cruel and backed by foreigners to boot. Because the U.S. lies, Russia cannot be lying, or else vice versa. In another world, U.S. news media would help people understand events in a country most know little about, and particularly understand the role the U.S. has and is playing there. Instead, media's evident point of vantage is that reflected in a tweet from Anne Marie Slaughter, a senior State Department official under Hillary Clinton in the Obama administration. Quote, "I believe that the U.S., U.K., and France did the right thing by striking Syria over chemical weapons. It will not stop the war, nor save the Syrian people from many other horrors. It is illegal under international law. But it at least draws a line somewhere and says enough." Close quote. Those with pointed questions about when, where, and why the United States says enough and what actually happens when it claims to will need to look outside corporate media for that conversation and even the information with which to have it. Gregory Shupak teaches media studies at the University of Guelph-Humber in Toronto, and he's author of the new book, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media. Almost out, available by pre-order from Orr Books. He's also been writing for FAIR. Welcome to Counterspin, Greg Shupak.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the lead headline on the New York Times homepage on the night or early morning of this most recent missile strike read, U.S. attacks Syria in retaliatory strike. Britain and France join strikes to show Western resolve. So this is the story, as many, if not most, Americans will understand it. And we're to understand that what the U.S. is retaliating against is an April 7th chemical weapons attack by Assad's forces on Douma, a city outside Damascus, and a holdout of anti-Assad forces. So there is, and it's acknowledged, dispute over whether there was an attack of chemical weapons, and if there was, whether or not it was in fact ordered by Assad. But before all of that, whatever happened in Douma, whether there was an attack or not, who ordered it or not, did the United States have the right to carry out this most recent airstrike?
No, I mean, not under international law. It's fairly clear, as I understand it, under international law, that you can only carry out military force with the blessing of the UN Security Council, which the United States did not have in this case, the United States and its allies, I should say. The only other scenario where such actions can be taken would be if Syria was directly attacking the United States or was on the verge of doing so, which, of course, hasn't happened. So from a legal perspective, no, they don't have a right. From any moral or ethical perspective, I cannot conceive of any justification for the United States attacking Syria. The most common justification offered is that the Syrian government was, according to this line of argument, had carried out a chemical weapons attack, and that is evidently a bridge too far. However, among other problems with that line of argument, we can keep in mind that, as you said, the evidence is at this point very unclear as to whether an attack happened or who carried it out if it did. Even if for the sake of argument we say, okay, the Syrian government did it, let's say there's unambiguous evidence of that, well, it's still unclear as to what would give the United States and its partners the right to carry out a further bombing campaign against Syria, because they have been bombing Syria quite a bit in a variety of contexts over the years, and what possible good that could do for the people of Syria, because the U.S.'s record, the policy record in Syria throughout the course of the 7 years of war in that country strongly indicates that the United States is not at all interested in the welfare of the Syrian people. And I think on a gut level, most people realize that bombing a country is not likely to help the people therein.
Well, you know, it's pretty much the only response on the table, you know, that somehow attacking bad will create good. But I want to bring you back, first of all, to the history, because it's frankly missing from many of the current media accounts, which often include quotes from officials or pundits that say the U.S. needs to come off the sidelines. The U.S. needs to just do something. And that's something that you've written about for FAIR.org. And I wonder if you can fill in for listeners. What are we missing from the history, from this idea that the U.S. needs to, as of now, get involved in Syria?
Yeah, it's remarkable how widespread this information is, this misinformation that says the United States or the West generally have not acted in Syria. I mean, it depends how far back we want to go. Do we want to go to, the dividing up of the Middle East after World War I? Do we want to go to the CIA carrying out a coup in the late 40s against Syria's democratically elected government? I'm being somewhat facetious because I assume you mean more recent years. So we can start by saying that in the years leading up to the war taking place in Syria, there was a significant effort on the part of the United States to help drum up anti-government sentiments through things like funding opposition groups in the country, or more specifically funding sectarian-oriented organizations to drum up fears of a Shia takeover of the country via Iranian influence. But if we want to go to really the heart of the matter, I think we have to start talking about the war that began in 2011. And in the 7 years of that war, the United States has done a number of things. It certainly hasn't done nothing, but what it has done includes funding to the tune of, depending on what estimate you go by, the Washington Post had put it at $1 billion a year. Other estimates are lower. But through that program, a CIA covert operation, which the New York Times called one of the most expensive covert operations in the CIA's history, the United States has armed and funded Syrian opposition groups. These groups are not the freedom-loving Democrats that sometimes they are made out to be in mainstream media, at least not the ones that have the most power in the Syrian opposition at this point. And U.S. arms and funding have helped directly and indirectly some groups that have done some pretty ugly things, carrying out massacres, using a variety of forms of violence and repression against people who oppose them. And in particular, these have often been targeted at Syria's minority groups. So the thing about pouring weapons into a country is that people have a habit of using weapons when they get them. So in this respect, the United States has, to quote a New York Times article from a couple of years ago, helped fuel the war. Another key role that the U.S. has played has been in derailing negotiations that had a chance, possibly, of going somewhere earlier in the years of the war. We don't know precisely what would have happened had those not been inhibited, but at least there's a chance that this war could have ended when the casualty figures were a fraction of what they are now and the refugee numbers were a lot lower than they are now. And then there's this other dimension, which is that after ISIS got a really significant foothold in Syria, which we have evidence to indicate has occurred in large part because of the U.S. pouring weapons into the country, those went to groups that in many cases had members join ISIS or were defeated by ISIS and simply, you know, had their weapons taken by ISIS. So it was America pouring weapons into the country had a very direct role in enabling ISIS. So once ISIS came to global attention, the United States started bombing Syria along with Iraq, ostensibly to attempt to unseat the group. In so doing, the United States has killed between, according to Air Wars, which I think is a pretty credible source, 3,000 to 5,000 Syrian civilians. The United States has completely destroyed Raqqa, a Syrian city, which was ISIS's de facto capital. And in the process of bombing Syria to apparently take on ISIS, the United States began building military bases in the country. So now it has a substantial foothold in Syria. There are at present 10 U.S. bases that are known to exist in Syria, with two more under construction. This indicates that the U.S. has a desire to remain in Syria for the longer term and to manage Syria's affairs. The United States is engaged, of course, in a variety of attacks against the Syrian government and its allies, including one Friday, as well as a comparable one in April 2017, but others have got less attention. So that's a brief overview, or as brief as I can provide, of what U.S. policy has been towards Syria. The one other thing I would add to it, I guess, is that it can be tricky to separate U.S. policy in Syria from the policy of U.S. allies in Syria. So we know, for instance, that the United States and Saudi Arabia worked hand in glove in an operation funding Syrian opposition groups and providing them with weaponry and other types of support. We know that other U.S. allies like Qatar and Turkey and Jordan, the relationship with Turkey is fraught at the moment, but it wasn't always quite so frayed. So we know that these allies have funded a lot of rather dodgy, sectarian, religiously conservative organizations that have had a strongly racist bent to them at times in Syria. So there's a lot of reasons to suggest that the United States had no real objection to, at the very least, doing what these other countries, mostly from the Gulf, were up to. I think that we can say that the U.S. is at a minimum complicit in the role that its regional allies have played in keeping Syria's bloodshed going. And to add to that list, I think we also have to include Israel, which of course is sort of de facto 51st U.S. state that happens to be in the Middle East. Israel has, according to its own estimates, carried out 100 roughly attacks on Syria, bombing attacks more specifically, carried out untold other forms of military operation, funded an armed insurgency. So the point I'm trying to make is that when we look at the U.S. role in Syria, I think we have to also kind of take into account the role of other countries that are very intimately linked with the United States. So if you have countries funding opposition groups that have carried out brutal attacks against civilians, but the U.S. continues selling weapons to and providing military aid to these countries like Qatar or Saudi Arabia, then that to me suggests the U.S. at minimum has no real objection to what they've been doing.
Well, yeah, and you know, the hypocrisy is almost so clear that it kind of gets stepped over in the conversations of, you know, quote unquote, smart people. You know, I say it a lot that American exceptionalism is kind of the card you show at the door to get into the serious foreign policy debate. You know,
for sure.
It's different because it's us. You know, I mean, if chemical weapons are the problem, well, the U.S. has used chemical weapons, you know. If proxy wars are the problem, well, the U.S. uses proxy wars. So it's difficult to puzzle out, and particularly from media coverage, what even the line is supposed to be, which is why I use that Anne-Marie Slaughter quote, because it says, yeah, sure, we're violating international law, but they violated international law, so we have to get them, you know? I mean, how do you make sense of that?
Yeah, the Slaughter quote is very revealing, and one of the things I wrote for FAIR, which came out last week, I think it was called Major Papers Urge Trump to Kill Syrians and Risk World War III, I made the point that several of these media outlets invoke international law as a rationale for attacking Syria, but U.S. attacks on Syria are illegal under international law. So they're saying we have to break international law to uphold international law. In the chemical weapons issue, I mean, the U.S. is, you can read a report from The Intercept, there's evidence the U.S. has used chemical weapons in Syria itself, much less in Iraq, where that's pretty well documented too. And of course, you can go further back to other U.S. wars, or you can look at, you know, U.S. intimacy with Israel, which used white phosphorus in 2009 against Gaza. So, I mean, I can't imagine that anybody who isn't incredibly deluded genuinely believes that the United States is standing up to fight evil and to keep people safe from chemical weapons or any of that sort of rhetoric. So as far as I can tell, it's very often, if not always, just a blatant smokescreen for creating rationalizations for U.S. efforts to dominate the Middle East. And Syria is a crucial node in the Middle East. And very often the media outlets are kind of transparent about this, sometimes perhaps unintentionally so. But I'm looking right now at a piece I'm working at on the Washington Post's response, their editorial response to Trump's bombing of Syria, along, of course, with Britain and France. The Washington Post endorses this action, and they say, you know, that it's necessary basically to protect what they call American interests in Syria. And the article makes clear that what they consider American interests in Syria is keeping Iran out of the country, irrespective of how Syrians maybe feel about Iran having a role versus America having a role. That's just not something the paper is willing to look at. The paper talks about the importance of, quote, stabilizing and holding large stretches of territory now under de facto U.S. control, end quote. So what this kind of coverage, I think, reveals is that this talk about forcing international law or protecting people from horrific chemical weapons is not something that really is an actual sincere concern of, you know, the foreign policy establishment. What they're concerned about is what they call U.S. interests. And what U.S. interests mean is illegitimate American domination of countries thousands of miles away.
Right. And sometimes they outright say, we want their resources. Why should anyone else, including them, have control of their resources?
Yeah, that was made nakedly clear not long ago in the Washington Post. Michael Gerson, I wrote about this in a piece called U.S. Isn't Leaving Syria, but Media Lost It When Possibility Was Raised. I wrote that for FAIR. So Michael Gerson, writing in the Washington Post, openly said, I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially that it would be a shame to give up the control that the United States has over Syrian oil fields. So by some estimates, the U.S. has influence over, if not total control over, more than half of the oil fields in Syria. And Gerson, right there in one of the most influential papers in the United States, is saying that America should continue to pursue a policy that allows it to determine what happens with someone else's resources, someone else's very valuable resource, and a resource that could be used to perhaps help rebuild this country that has had its economy completely obliterated by being at the center of a proxy war for 7 years.
And just finally, I wonder where you see hope and a way forward. You know, Jonathan Cook put it in a piece, and it's everyone's going to be arguing about this forever, commenting on Robert Fisk's images from Syria. But that all aside, he says peace in Syria is the horror scenario for the United States. In other words, the United States and its Western partners are invested in something other than stability in Syria. I know that's a very difficult pill to swallow for a lot of United States citizens, that actually what are called the U.S. interests are not the interests of stopping violence, is not the interest in stopping killings of children that you see on the news. What's the way forward for people who actually don't want Syrians to pick who gets to bomb them, but want the bombs to stop?
Yeah. So, I mean, I agree with Cook's assessment. I think the U.S. ruling class has made pretty clear that they either want the Syrian government out and or to keep the war going for as long as possible so that Syria remains divided and weak and bleeding. Yeah, the way forward, I think, you know, people can only do things about the society that they live in. So, you know, I can't go and change what Russian policy is. I have absolutely no capacity to influence that in any way, nor can I influence the policy of the government, of any government that the state in which I live has poor to no relations with. So if I'm concerned about, you know, human rights abuses in some country that's an official enemy of Canada, you know, which is in effect basically means the United States 99% of the time, Canada's a node in the U.S. empire. But, you know, I don't have any capacity to do anything about what Russia does or what the Syrian government does that is objectionable. All the people, I think, in America and countries allied with America can do is say, call for the U.S. to get out and call for the U.S.'s allies to get out of Syria. We know from the record that the United States has done nothing but contribute to the horrors taking place in the country. It may not solve every problem. It won't solve every problem that Syria has, but we can make an important contribution towards the longer-term goal of giving the country a chance to rebuild and breathe and have at least minimal safety. And then perhaps under those conditions, there can be a way for Syrians to create conditions that work better for them than they had before the war and certainly during the war. So I think to go by the old kind of Chomskyan logic, we're responsible for what our governments do. And what our government does, what our governments do to Syria is unambiguously negative. And we can take a harm reduction approach and say, let's stop the harm that our governments are inflicting. And that can play a key role in winding down the war. One crucial thing, which I didn't mention, was sanctions. So the U.S., Canada, other Western countries have inflicted sanctions on Syria. These have caused enormous harm to ordinary Syrians. They've harmed water and sanitation. They've harmed energy. They've harmed the economy. They've harmed the medical system. So calling for an end to sanctions, that is another crucial aspect of what has to happen. So to me, the demand should be U.S. and its allies out of Syria, end the sanctions, accept more refugees. And these will go a long way to, at the very least, ensuring that the conflict doesn't get worse, because any measure that America and its partners have contemplated is certain to make it worse. So even if we can't make it drastically better, let's at least stop it from getting worse.
We've been speaking with Gregory Shupak from the University of Guelph Humber in Toronto. His new book, The Wrong Story, Palestine, Israel, and the Media, is available by pre-order from Orr Books. Thank you so much, Greg Shupak, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks again for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them and transcripts on FAIR's website, FAIR.org. That's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm coming to a difficult realization. We suffer through early signs of climate shift. Things like super hurricanes, storm surges, fires, and very strange weather. But the first and biggest hits of global warming are hidden from us, at the poles and in the ocean. Earth could experience catastrophic loss from climate change before humans realize it. You are about to hear breaking science pointing to hidden warning signs of extreme climate change. While we fret and sometimes die from heat waves on land, unreported marine heat waves are striking more often and more violently in the seas. Scientist Eric Oliver explains. Then Mark Eakins, the coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch, reports the latest science. Up to half the Great Barrier Reef of Australia has died in the longest marine heat wave ever seen. Most of the extra heat we generate with greenhouse gas emissions goes into the ocean. Hidden beneath the waves, that is where the climate action is. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. For years, we have been told that most of the extra heat from our greenhouse gases goes into the sea. But what is happening there? I've written to experts around the world trying to get the big picture of marine warming. Crickets. Well, finally, we have a new paper published in the journal Nature, and it warns us about marine heat waves. The lead author is Eric J. Oliver. He earned his PhD in physical oceanography from Dalhousie University in Canada's Maritime Province of Nova Scotia. Eric has also been a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Tasmania. Many of his co-authors are Australian, with more authors from the UK, particularly Scotland and the United States. From Halifax, Canada, Eric Oliver, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, as you know, on land, a heat wave is pretty relative. People in the UK think they're cooking at 28 C or 82 Fahrenheit. That's just another day in Pakistan. So how do you define a marine heat wave?
Well, you make a really good point that what is or isn't a heat wave, what isn't extreme, is relative to what's normal in a particular region. So that is exactly what has informed the basis of our definition of marine heat wave. So we have a qualitative way of defining what is a marine heat wave. That is to say, it's a prolonged period of time where water temperatures are anomalously warm relative to what is expected at that time of year. And then we can further quantify that, which is what we did in this study, to say that a marine heat wave is triggered when water temperatures are higher than the 90th percentile for a particular time of year, and that persists for at least 5 days. And what the 90th percentile means is that it's a temperature that you would expect 9 days out of 10 to be less than. So 1 day out of 10 is that hot or hotter. And so if that temperature is exceeded for 5 whole days in a row, at least, then we've entered a marine heat wave state. And because that percentile calculation is dependent on the actual variability of temperature, that scales by region. So in somewhere like the tropics, where there's not a lot of variability of temperature, the percentile allows us to trigger a heat wave when it's only maybe 1 or 2 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures, because that is quite extreme in the tropics. Whereas here, say off the east coast of Canada, the water temperatures are really variable. That might not be triggered until it's 3, 4, 5 degrees warmer than average.
And what got you looking into this, and why has this information been so hard to find?
In 2011, there was a marine heat wave that occurred off the west coast of Australia. And while these kind of extreme temperature events in the ocean have happened before, and certainly to a large degree are evident in the natural world, this one gained a lot of attention because it was so extreme. It was the coastal temperature loggers measured 5 degrees warmer than average in the middle of summer. And offshore measurements recorded by satellite said 6 to 7 degrees warmer than typical summer temperatures. And this event persisted for an entire month. So it was oceanographically and climatically really interesting and anomalous, but also there were impacts on ecosystems. So there were fish that were found out of range. There were fishery closures because of temperature sensitivity and things like abalone. And there were, the most interesting to me is the kelp forest ecosystem collapsed under the temperature stress, and there was a rise in the seagrass ecosystems in its place. And in fact, that change from kelp to seagrass has persisted since the event in 2011. So this event that came along caused an impact, and then the event went away, but the impact remained. That kind of ability to, the ability of a transient event to permanently affect the system really shocked people, and it was quite interesting, let's say, from a scientific perspective. So a researcher based at the University of Western Australia, Professor Thomas Wernberg, brought together a few people to lead this working group on marine heat waves. So himself, Dan Smale, who's based in the UK, Marine Biological Association, myself and Professor Neil Holbrook. Neil is still, and I was at the University of Tasmania at the time, the four of us led this workshop that was held in Perth, Western Australia, in 2015. And we brought together a total of 15 researchers from around the world, from all those countries you mentioned at the beginning. And we cut across three main fields of expertise. We had climate scientists with a lot of experience in extremes. We had physical oceanographers, and we had the marine ecologists. And we got together for 3 days, and it's often hard to speak the same language when you've got a physical person and a biological person trying to talk about the same thing. We often, even the same words can mean different things. But if you're in the same room trying to have this conversation over a few days, you get there. And that's what we were able to do. And the outcome of this workshop was that we ended up with three lines of research that we would then scatter back around the world and pursue. And one of them was actually, how do you define a heat wave, which is how we came up with that definition that was published in 2016. And one of the other lines of research was, what can we say about the global record of marine heat waves? What's the global distribution like, and are there any long-term trends happening? The expectation being that there might be, given the kind of long-term warming we've been seeing in the ocean and the atmosphere for the last, well, decades to centuries.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the paper, I have to say, like, if fish run short due to marine heat waves, that can start minor battles between countries. It can threaten protein sources for millions of people. So this is a very important topic, and I'm surprised there haven't been more studies on this before.
Well, that's a really good point. And I think, I mean, there are a couple points to make about that. One is that there have been studies on marine heat waves. If you look up marine heat wave on Google Scholar, say, if you just type in the keywords, there's been essentially an exponential increase in that term being used. In the past, certainly people would have talked about sea surface temperature extremes or temperature anomalies, things like that. Certainly El Nino, that happens in the tropical eastern Pacific, you could characterize that as a marine heat wave. It's a period of time, quite prolonged, where water temperatures are very high. In 2003, there was an event in the Mediterranean, and that was published. They didn't use the term marine heat wave, but it fits very much into our framework. So people have been looking at these, but I would say that the difference between what happens in the ocean and what happens on land or in the atmosphere over land is that it's so much harder to see what goes on in the ocean. So when we have a heat wave on land, the most obvious impact is that humans feel stressed. We get hot. We don't want to do very much. We're sweaty. But we also see that, well, our animals get stressed out. In Australia, for example, they have flying foxes, which is like a large kind of bat, that once air temperatures reach 42 degrees, they just fall out of the trees that they hang on while they sleep. So the impacts are much more obvious in the atmosphere, whereas in the ocean, if you're a fisherman or if you're an ecologist who's out there interacting with the ocean regularly, then you can see that things are changing, although maybe you don't actually know that the water temperatures change unless you're measuring it. And the rest of us just kind of notice, oh, the beach is warmer today. So it's, I would say that these events in the ocean are more hidden, so it's easier for them to go by unnoticed.
It recently hit the news that a swordfish was seen off the coast of British Columbia, and we also have seen more of the big tropical sunfish. So some surprising things are happening out there. We also had the blob, that this big pool of hot water that hung off the North Pacific, off the coast of Washington State and British Columbia for quite some time. Is that part of what you're studying?
Exactly. That is another example of a marine heat wave. That is a pretty interesting one because it was so persistent. A lot of these events that blink on and off around the world tend to be on the scale of maybe a few weeks to a few months, whereas that event persisted for something like 2 or more than 2 years. But it does nonetheless fit into our framework of what we think of as a marine heat wave, a prolonged period of anomalously high ocean temperatures. And it had the same kind of impacts. There were range extensions of different kinds of fish. There were fishery closures, marine mammal strandings, I believe, toxic algal bloom outbreaks. That one was interesting, though, because it actually fed back on the atmosphere, right, and affected weather patterns over Western North America.
It did, and I lived through it. Now, in your study, you talk about comparing periods starting around 1925 and moving up towards the present. How can we possibly know what the sea surface temperatures were in the 1920s or 30s?
Well, ships have been out measuring them, basically. But the longer answer to that question is that getting the right data sources and pulling the data together in the right way was a big part of that study, and I'd say one of the big successes of the study. So to define a marine heat wave, we really need daily measurements, fairly high-frequency measurements of temperature. And we were interested in doing this globally, so we needed this information globally. And that kind of information really has only been available since the early 1980s, since satellites have been recording surface ocean temperatures daily. However, we were able to supplement that data with two other sources of data. So one would be daily measurements, not global, but at a few sites around the world where they have recorded temperatures for a very long time, 100 years and more in some cases. Places like the lighthouses in BC, for example. There's a few stations along the west coast of the U.S. and some in Europe. These are just examples where over 100 years ago, someone decided we need to start recording temperatures, and they would go out to the shore with a bucket, literally, and measure it, or measure it off the end of the pier. And that has persisted until now. So we have these truly invaluable records of ocean temperatures, in situ coastal ocean temperatures. But that's not global. A third data set that we have that is global are analyses and amalgamations of data that would be recorded from ships that have been going around the oceans for hundreds of years, really. Ships have always been recording ocean temperatures. And these are more infrequent, and there are products that take these data and grid them and provide them in regular packages. And that can effectively give us global monthly measurements of temperature. So we have these three data sources: satellites, a few stations, and these ship-based records that can each have their own strength, whether it's daily, global, or long-term. And we're able to effectively borrow the strengths of each data set together to construct this record of marine heat waves going back to 1900.
So in the period from 1925 to 2016, did the frequency of heat waves increase?
It did. So our results show that there was a statistically significant increase in the frequency of marine heat waves. And we define frequency to mean the number of events that happen on average per year as a global average. So it's very average, but we're taking a global picture. And the data is showing us that in the early part of the 20th century, there were little over 2 events that would happen per year. Whereas in the latter part of the record, so basically the last 30 years or so, that's increased to, in very recent years, up to 4 events per year, but on average, something like 3 events per year. I think that's a 34% increase, if I remember the number from the paper correctly.
And what about the duration? What did you find there? How long they last?
Similarly, so we defined this average duration, which is to say, you have so many events occurring per year, how long are they on average? Some events can be quite a bit longer, some are shorter, but on average in the early 20th century, they were about 10 days long. Whereas in the last 30 years, they've lengthened out to up to 14 days long.
So we're getting more of them and they're lasting longer. This sounds serious.
Correct, yeah. And while thinking about frequency and duration, it can be a bit confusing maybe to think about that in a simple way. So an easier way is actually just to think of, well, how many days per year are part of a marine heat wave, or how many marine heat wave days are there per year? How many days are ecosystems going to be exposed to extreme temperatures? So if you have a certain number of events per year and they have a certain duration, then you have a certain number of days that are part of those heat waves. And that number has increased by 50% over the time period that we examined. So it's something like 30-ish days on average per year in the early 20th century, and that's increased up to around 40-45.
Now, we have natural cycles that you do talk about in the paper, like La Nina and El Nino and those sort of things. I'd like to leave those aside for a minute and zero in on what is the background sea surface warming trend, which, according to the paper, is 0.16 degrees C per decade. If that's true, one would think that over the past 100 years, the sea surface would have warmed by about 1.6 degrees C, and that is actually greater than what is reported for land warming.
Well, we do know, actually, that the ocean is a huge reservoir for a lot of the warming that's happening around the globe. So in a way, it's unfortunate that the impacts are so hidden and our attentions are diverted away from the ocean, because a lot of change that's happening in recent decades is happening in the ocean.
And it must take a massive amount of energy to increase the sea surface temperature at all.
Yes, I imagine it would do, yes.
And it's going to release that slowly, that heat. The whole ocean is going to release that heat again very slowly over centuries or longer. I've also encountered, along talking with various scientists, that there will become a point where the ocean ceases to become such an effective heat sink for our greenhouse gases. It should slow down their absorption rate, and then we get whatever we put into the atmosphere will come back on us much quicker. But I guess that's outside the boundaries of this study, is it?
Yeah, that's a longer timescale thing, but it's something that we need to be cognizant of when we're thinking about this. So what's going on there is that when we think about the oceans warming, we're often thinking about, well, it's the surface ocean that's warming. And there are certain areas around the globe where that surface water is convected down to the deeper parts of the ocean. So the North Atlantic is one area, or all around the Southern Ocean is another area. And this process is a fundamental part of the global climate system. You can think of it crudely as a conveyor belt. Maybe you've heard the global conveyor belt terminology in the past. So this is, for example, in the Atlantic, you have warm water brought north near the surface. In the higher latitudes, it cools and is made more dense and drops to the deep. And the time scale for which that water stays in the deep before it comes back up to the ocean surface is something like 1,000 or thousands of years. So now we're at the beginning of that process where the earlier tracks of that global conveyor belt, let's say, have this warmer water that's newly warmed because we've been warming the climate system over the last one and a half centuries. But as we continue to warm it, and as it continues to pull it down, it's going to fill up that conveyor belt with the warm water. And once it's filled up, then it won't have that capacity to store it away anymore effectively.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With me is Canadian ocean scientist Dr. Eric Oliver. We are discussing his new paper, Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. Eric, let's talk about what is happening in different parts of the world. Why don't we start with the region where you live, the Maritime Provinces of Canada, and of course, New England. What does your study show there?
Well, we didn't focus very much on the regional impacts, actually, in our study. We were trying to elucidate what's the global average trend, really, to make more bulk statements. But you can look at what the changes are regionally, and certainly on the long time scale of 100, 115 years, effectively almost the entire ocean is experiencing these positive trends in the marine heat wave properties that we looked at. There's really only a few places where we don't see increases in the marine heat wave properties, and that really maps onto regions where we don't see strong increases in ocean temperatures. The biggest, the most conspicuous region being the far North Atlantic, and this has been noted before. There's what they've called a global warming hole in the high latitudes in the North Atlantic, where it actually appears to be cooling or not warming at all, certainly on a 100-year time scale or so. And the consensus, as I understand it, that's emerging now is that this is being related to a slowdown in the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, which is one of the limbs of this conveyor belt I was talking about. It's that part of the North Atlantic that brings warm water or brings surface water down to the deep.
I didn't see any discussion in the paper of the actual Arctic Ocean. Is that why?
No, and that's because we excluded regions that had ice cover for longer than 5 days, which is most areas that have any kind of regular occurrence of ice. And that was mainly for statistical reasons, because we didn't want, because of the definition of a heat wave having to last for at least 5 days, it would have interfered with our ability to calculate heat waves. But that being said, it's obviously very important to look in those regions, in the Arctic and around the Southern Ocean as well. And now that I'm based back here in Canada and interested in these higher latitudes, I think it's something that I will be looking into pretty soon.
Yeah, we just had news of an ocean heat wave in the Tasman Sea between Australia and New Zealand, and I know you were working in Australia. What are marine scientists saying there, and how much is this part of the great threat to the Great Barrier Reef?
So what happens in the Tasman Sea and around southeastern Australia, I would say, is decoupled from what happens in the Great Barrier Reef in the sense of the specific drivers of those events, not talking about global climate change. What happens around Tasmania is really, really interesting because Tasmania is a cool water ecosystem generally. So we have a lot of cool water species that have refuge there because much of the waters around Australia are much warmer. But unlike, say, here in North America, where if waters tend to warm, the cold water species might just migrate further north, in Tasmania, in Australia, you don't have any higher latitudes, actually. Tasmania is as cold as you get, and then you've got 3,000 kilometers of Southern Ocean before you find Antarctica. So when things happen there, when the waters are warming there, it can have really detrimental impacts. And they're losing things like their giant kelp forests, and a lot of their fisheries and aquaculture systems are under stress.
And when it comes to the long-term viability of at-risk ecosystems like coral or the food fisheries, or as you mentioned, why do you think heat waves matter even more than the gradual increase of mean sea surface temperature?
Well, I'd say they both matter. The key is that when an impact happens, generally, that's not because the mean has warmed. That's because an extreme has occurred, an extreme event has occurred, that extreme event sitting on top of the mean, which may have warmed, but the extreme event has occurred that's pushed something over some kind of a threshold. So really, it's the extremes that we feel. In the summertime, maybe, let's just say for the sake of argument, that this summer is 1 degree warmer than a typical summer 30 or 40 years ago. You're not really going to feel the difference between 25 and 24, say. But that extra degree can push the frequency of the more extreme events, those heat waves that are up in the 30s, that extra 1 degree can push the frequency of those extremes up in a way that you do feel them. And that's the same thing for marine heat waves. So the mean is important, but we feel the extremes, I guess, is the way to phrase that.
And just the idea of marine heat waves stimulates so many new fields of research. I think we could look, for example, at the effect on algae blooms. I've talked to experts on plankton, and they say, well, we don't really know how this is going to go, whether it will increase or decrease with global warming. And then we have the whole idea of marine heat interacting with storms. We know a hotter ocean can drive bigger hurricanes. There's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I think this is exactly the list that you put there, and I could add more. It opens up a very broad range of topics to study, and the thing I find exciting about it is that it opens up these topics that have cross-disciplinary aspects. So you listed a few that would mean physical and climate scientists working alongside ecologists or fishery scientists or working alongside hurricane researchers and forecasters and things like that, and that's one of the things I find it very exciting about it. It has this sort of cross-disciplinary impact.
I realize science really reports on the past, but what are your thoughts, Eric, about the future of marine heat waves as global warming continues?
That's a really good question. So in our study, we showed that the rising marine heat wave metrics were primarily driven by the rising mean ocean temperatures. So effectively, the global warming of the oceans is what is driving this increased frequency and duration of the marine heat waves. And while we didn't demonstrate in our study, we can rely on other published works that have effectively shown that global warming of the oceans is an anthropogenic signal. And so therefore, the rising trends that we see are predominantly driven by anthropogenic or human-caused climate change. And so the next step then is to exactly what you say. How is this going to continue into the future? How do we expect these trends to go throughout the rest of the 21st century, and that's actually what we're working on now. And to do that, we need to turn to models. Obviously, we don't know what it's going to be like in 20, 30, 40 years, but we have fairly sophisticated and very good computer models for the climate system, for the oceans. And so we can use these models to simulate a projected future state of the ocean under different kinds of emission scenarios to tell us what we might expect the future state of the oceans to look like and the future state of marine heat waves. I will say that regardless of what those results show specifically, and that's work in progress, so I can't give you any numbers, it is the case that regardless of how we change our emissions, I'm talking about greenhouse gas emissions globally, the climate system has so much inertia in it now from the emissions that we've put in the system that it's not going to stop. It's not going to start cooling right away. So even if we were to stop emitting greenhouse gases right now, it's going to continue warming for at least the next few decades. And so we can expect these trends to continue regardless of what we do, at least for the near future.
Is there anybody responsible for watching out for marine heat waves? I mean, do we even have a real-time marine heat wave reporting system?
Not really, and that's something that needs to be, or it would be great if it was tackled. In the tropics, I would say that they've been looking at extreme ocean temperatures and thinking about these for much longer than, say, the mid-latitudes or the higher latitudes. And they are certainly aware of extreme temperatures in the tropics because of its impact on coral. So there are some programs like Coral Reef Watch that's run out of NOAA that does exactly what you're saying. They have real-time monitoring of ocean temperatures across the tropics, but it's not more broad than that. It doesn't function for the mid-latitude regions. So that's something that it will be really good to implement, both real-time, but also hooking this definition of what a marine heat wave is into our forecast systems, because we have seasonal forecast systems that can give us some confidence about ocean temperatures 2, 3, 4, 6 months from now.
I didn't know that, and it would be interesting to see ocean forecasts. And one last question, and I don't want to be too dramatic here, but is there a possibility we'll get to the point of unexpected disasters for marine life due to a marine heat wave?
Well, I think we've actually already seen that in some regions. I mean, that kelp forest collapse being replaced by seagrass meadows on the west coast of Australia was absolutely unexpected. And I don't think it's been so disastrous for humans, but I think it was quite disastrous for some of the marine creatures living there. In 2012, there was one of these events that occurred here off the east coast of Canada and the U.S., and water temperatures in the spring were very high, anomalously high, and this caused the lobster fishery to unexpectedly have a massive increase in the number of landings earlier than usual. So the lobsters flooded the industry, flooded the system, and there was an unexpected drop in price, and there were a whole range of downstream effects on that, which led to economic and political tensions between Canada and the U.S. So I would say we're already seeing little hints of these kind of tensions and unexpected consequences arising.
We have been talking with Dr. Eric Oliver about the totally underreported phenomenon of marine heat waves. Eric and 14 other scientists from around the world have released an important new study in Nature Communications. The title is Longer and More Frequent Marine Heat Waves Over the Past Century. You can find links to the paper and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Eric, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The world's biggest structure built by living organisms is not Tokyo or New York. It is the Great Barrier Reef off Queensland, Australia, in the Coral Sea. It is over 1,400 miles long, 2,300 kilometers. It is a nursery for countless ocean species. And, as we learn in a horrifying new scientific report, the Great Barrier Reef is dying, killed by the hot seas of global warming. The title of the new paper published in the journal Nature is Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. We have reached co-author Dr. C. Mark Eakin. Mark is the coordinator of the Coral Reef Watch, run by NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And as they say at that site, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch provides the only source of satellite-based monitoring, alerts, and warnings of upcoming coral mass bleaching events. From Maryland, Mark Eakin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
I've just spoken with Dr. Eric Oliver, whose team published a paper on global increases of marine heat waves. Tell us what happened to the sea temperatures off Queensland's coast of Australia in 2016.
Yes, and in fact, that's a very good paper to have come out just before our paper, because that's what we were looking at, is one of these marine heat waves, actually two of them, that struck Australia's Great Barrier Reef. This was, in fact, part of a global coral mass bleaching event. This was the third global bleaching event to ever occur. The first was in 1998, the second in 2010, and this one, surprisingly, lasted for 3 years, from 2014 to 2017, including the two events on the Great Barrier Reef in 2016 and 2017. So in 2016, the Great Barrier Reef was hit by one of these marine heat waves, striking mostly the northern and far northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. That section, unfortunately for the corals, was one that had never seen heat stress like this before. So these sort of marine heat waves had not hit the northern Great Barrier Reef, and the corals were much more sensitive than most corals are because they hadn't been exposed to these kinds of conditions. And so the heat wave struck. We had mass coral bleaching and mortality. And in fact, the corals up there in the northern section were bleaching and dying at about half the level of heat stress that we usually see.
And how did this team and this project get going?
So the work being done in Australia is a part of ongoing efforts through James Cook University, the Australian Research Council Center of Excellence for Coral Reef Studies, the Australian Institute of Marine Science, the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, and they have efforts going on to study coral reefs on the Great Barrier Reef on an ongoing basis. And in fact, Australian Institute of Marine Science has, in the past, when these large-scale bleaching events have hit in Australia, two of them being in 98 and 2002, they had used overflights, aircraft overflights, to see how much bleaching there was, as well as having divers who go out and look in the water to see what the after effects were, going out months later to see how much coral may have died. At the same time, NOAA's Coral Reef Watch that I run is an organization that's always monitoring for coral bleaching everywhere in the world, using a combination of satellite monitoring as well as climate models. And so since we have the data on the amount of heat stress that the corals exhibited, they had the data from the work, both the aerial surveys and now the in-water surveys, to understand how much coral had bleached and died. We worked together on this paper. It's actually the third of the papers that we've worked together on regarding these bleaching events.
Now, you say it was pretty well a three-year event of ocean heating, but I was pretty shocked at the figures that came out from just the 2016 period. I mean, your paper lists almost 4,000 different reefs. How much was lost in that period just in 2016?
In 2016 alone, the Great Barrier Reef lost just under 30% of its corals. So it's a huge number of corals. And, you know, most of that, because the majority of the heat and the most sensitive corals were both together in the northern part, the majority of the corals that died in 2016 were up in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef.
Which happens to be a huge tourism area, so people expecting to see bright coral will still see some, I'm told by the Australians, but less and less as we go on. I wanted to talk about two different ways these changes show up that you talk about in the paper. The first is something called three-dimensionality. What does that mean?
Well, coral reefs are very important because they provide habitats for so many different animals, and they do that by forming structure. So, you know, grass is a plant, trees are plants, but grass and trees provide different kind of structure to animals that live in them. And coral reefs are the same way. Coral reefs provide that three-dimensional structures like trees do. So coral reefs actually serve very much the same way that forests do in providing a lot of structure. And so it's those corals that provide, you know, the corals that grow up in branching forms and tabular forms and really provide that relief, that are the ones that provide the most and the most variety of habitat for other animals. And in fact, it's those fast-growing corals, the ones that provide most of that structure, are the ones that were hit the hardest.
Now, when they die, do they just topple over, or do they have to be hit by storms, or how do they lose that dimensionality?
Well, you're right. In one case, it is that they will be hit by storms, and they'll be weakened at that point. The other thing, and some other work that we've been doing with additional colleagues, has found that when these events happen, you actually very quickly start seeing bioerosion, or the breakdown of the reef by natural processes. Every coral reef is a balance between processes to build the reef and destroy the reef. I mean, if that weren't the case, the entire ocean bottom would be covered with coral reef. So coral reefs are constantly being broken down by fish like parrotfish, sea urchins and things that crawl around and scrape away the surface, worms and crabs and types of shellfish like mussels that will bore into the reef, and even sponges and types of algae and bacteria that will make pores inside of the coral. And all of these weaken the structure, break it down, turn reef material into sand, and that's how you get a lot of the sand on the beaches, especially along the Great Barrier Reef. The shoreline is covered with the sand that's been formed by corals. But all of these forces will start to take over and will very quickly start breaking things down. In fact, in Hawaii, as a part of a bleaching we had in 2014 in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands, we saw a dramatic reduction in the amount of structure on that reef in under a year.
So a lot of those creatures that you've been talking about, I guess, are the second aspect discussed in the paper, which is labeled ecological functioning. Do you want to talk about that briefly?
That's right. So if you're going to have a very diverse coral reef ecosystem, first, you have to have a variety of habitats formed by a diverse group of corals. If you have nothing but the same corals, and in fact the ones that survive best are these massive or boulder corals, they just look like big rocks. They don't provide a lot of hiding holes for animals on the reef. And so when you have all these branching structures and tabular structures and folio structures, you know, things that are shaped in all kinds of weird and wonderful shapes, you have all kinds of habitat for animals, whether it's fish, shrimp, crabs, worms, you name it. The Great Barrier Reef, just like any coral reef, is a very diverse habitat. And especially in the north, it's more diverse than the rest of the Great Barrier Reef. And so when these corals die, you immediately start losing some of those fish and other organisms that will no longer have their homes, they'll no longer have the sources of productivity. And so it not only causes a breakdown in the corals themselves, but a breakdown of the actual ecosystem as a whole.
And how much above normal heat did those waters go?
So the way we measure this heat stress is not in degrees, but in something called degree weeks. So if you imagine you have a hot day, that's stressful, but it's one day. Heat waves that cause problem on land and where people, you know, die from heat during heat waves, it's because those events are not only hot, but they continue for days and days and days. Well, these marine heat waves are lasting for weeks to even a few months. And during that time, the temperature is above normal. So if you have temperatures that are, say, 2 degrees Celsius above the normal warmest month temperature, then we'll measure that as 2 degree weeks of stress. If the following week you have another week of 2 degrees, then you're now up to 4 degree weeks of stress. Normally, though, it doesn't go at levels quite that high. The temperatures usually during these events are in the range of 1 to 2 degrees Celsius above the normal maximum. And so when we add these up, you get values of heat stress that normally at 4 degree weeks of stress, you see significant bleaching. And at 8 degree weeks of stress, you see widespread bleaching and significant mortality. in this event, in the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef, they were seeing bleaching at 2 degree weeks of stress and starting to see mortality as, in some cases, as low as 3 degree weeks of stress. So they were really being affected at a lower level than we're used to.
But I would presume that's because they're closer to the tropics, so that there is less normal variation, whereas as you get towards the poles, there is more variation. So maybe the creatures are more used to it.
Well, that's true, but it's not a matter of variation that we're talking about here. It's how much warmer it is than normal. So, you know, there are coral reefs in places that have a lot of variability. I mean, you know, places like Florida, you know, temperatures will swing much more up and down than they will in the southern Caribbean. Same thing on the Great Barrier Reef. When you get to the southern Great Barrier Reef, which, of course, is closer to the pole, they have more temperature variation normally than they do in the northern Great Barrier Reef, which is near the equator. But the concern isn't that total amount of variability, but how far they get above that upper limit that the corals are used to.
Were there particular conditions like an El Nino or La Nina or something else that led to this long-standing marine heat wave off the coast of Australia?
There was. In fact, that was a part of what was going on in this global bleaching event. We usually see the most bleaching going on during the second year of an El Nino. And in fact, I mentioned those previous global bleaching events. The 98 event and the 2010 event were both in years, in the second year of an El Nino. Well, in 2014, we started seeing a lot of heat stress, and we saw what looked like was going to be an El Nino. We were expecting a 2014-2015 El Nino. The ocean heated up in ways that looked like an El Nino, but the atmosphere never responded, and you need to have both in place to kick in and really form an El Nino. So as a result, there wasn't a 2014-2015 El Nino. We joke about it being the El No-Show. But in 2015, then it started up again. We had the heat in the ocean. The atmosphere responded. And we had a 2015-2016 El Nino. And so what you're seeing at this point was that this El Nino was in place when the bleaching occurred in 2016. Now, interestingly enough, that stopped. We switched into La Nina conditions, and the 2017 marine heat wave the next year in Australia occurred during La Nina conditions. So one of the things that's important here is that we're no longer just seeing these things driven by El Nino or La Nina, but instead the warming that's gone on as a part of climate change has increased the temperatures of the ocean so that they're close to those thermal limits already. So it takes very little to push it over the top.
So, Mark, looking into your own private research, separate from this paper, I want to ask you, aside from the global warming caused by our greenhouse gases, does the presence of more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere affect coral directly?
It does, but in a secondary way. Corals build their skeletons of calcium carbonate, in other words, limestone. To do that, they have to have plenty of carbonate in the water. That is something that is harder for the corals to build their skeletons out of calcium carbonate when the water is more acidic. When you have more acid in the water, they don't build their skeletons as well. And the organisms that will naturally erode coral reefs are able to do that even faster. So when we have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, more carbon dioxide goes into the water. That carbon dioxide dissociates and becomes carbonic acid, and it's a more acidic condition that's harder for corals to build their skeletons and easier for organisms like boring sponges and such to erode the reef. It's not something, though, that has a major effect on bleaching. There is some effect in some corals. It's been shown that some corals become more sensitive to high temperatures when the water is more acidic, but it's not true of all corals. In fact, we're not really sure just how widespread that is. Most corals do grow more slowly, but that really comes into play after an event like this, and you're looking to see how well the reef can recover.
In June 2016, as this disaster unfolded, I interviewed the world's greatest coral expert, Charlie Varon. He'd just flown back from looking at the reefs. His life work of exploring and cataloging the wonderful world of coral was being killed off. How are Australian scientists you've worked with taking this terrible news about the coral?
Oh, well, they've been living through it. It's been a bit of a nightmare in most cases, where reefs that they've been studying for years have been just completely destroyed. Now, you know, you have to keep in mind, though, that we're not saying the entire Great Barrier Reef is gone. It killed, say, you know, somewhere in the range of about a billion corals, but there's still about a billion corals left on the Great Barrier Reef. 2016, bleaching was mostly on. There was a bit of bleaching farther south, but not too far. The 2017 event then hit more in the central Great Barrier Reef. And the central Great Barrier Reef is more the area where tourists go, and there are a lot of activities. So, you know, between those, there was a lot of destruction. And, in fact, in the 2 years combined, the Great Barrier Reef lost about half of all of its corals. So we're looking at an area where a lot of reefs are in bad shape. Some reefs are still surviving. Some corals are still surviving. And so most of the scientists are at the same time trying to document what happened and the problems of that bleaching event while trying to find ways to help the reef recover from these insults.
You know, when the ice, the Arctic sea ice, retreated in 2007 and it was jaw-dropping, it was unexpected, I was really shocked. I thought, all right, this is climate change. But I think this is another one of those events, but it hasn't really made the public consciousness outside of Australia of what is happening there.
Yeah, it's a big problem that people aren't realizing how much climate change is already going on and going on all around them. We never saw mass coral bleaching events before 1983, that really big El Nino that was occurring then. We never saw global bleaching events until 1998, and these have been increasing in frequency and intensity. Another paper that many members of the same team had in the journal Science about 2 months ago, we were able to analyze records from 100 sites around the world, coral reef sites, and we found that where in the 1980s we were seeing severe bleaching events once every 30 years, now we're seeing them once every 6 years. So this is a real acceleration. One thing that I would encourage your listeners to do if they haven't seen it yet and want to know more about this is watch the film Chasing Coral. You mentioned Charlie Varon. Charlie is in it. I'm in it briefly. I was one of the chief scientific advisors for it. And that film, Chasing Coral, really does a wonderful job of showing what's happening to the reefs, but does it while you follow the adventure of filmmakers and scientists and videographers who are trying to capture this bleaching event as it went on. So the 2016 bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef we're talking about right now is actually a major part of that film.
I will track that film down and put a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.org.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, the world's largest green radio show on nonprofit stations. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Mark Eakin from NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. We're talking about the latest assessment of coral death in the Great Barrier Reef off Australia's coast. And I think that, you know, is it too much to say that the reef system is becoming dead, or is it damaged? Do we expect recovery?
So what we've seen is the collapse of many of those coral reefs. I mean, you know, you think about what happens if there's, say, a massive forest fire. Every tree isn't dead, but it's no longer functioning as a forest ecosystem. The trees aren't there. They don't provide the same habitats. The productivity isn't there. You have to see if you're going to have that recovery to come back as a forest, and that takes time. And it takes time for reefs to come back as well. Coral reefs that have suffered this sort of widespread coral death, you can start to see recovery in 10 to 15 years as you get a lot of the fastest growing corals coming back. But that's like having that forest fire and then coming back with shrubs. they're part of the process. They do provide cover, but they're not the whole thing. You've lost your big old trees, or in this case, your big old corals as well. And corals that take decades to centuries to grow in the first place take decades to centuries to recover as well. So yes, reefs can recover, but as I was saying, that recent paper we had in Science says that we're looking at the return of severe bleaching events once every 6 years, but yet even for that initial growth of coral cover, it takes 10 to 15. So we already are at a point where the recovery is taking longer than the return time of the events.
So now with this new paper in Nature, we do have a big red alarm flashing about a collapse in our environment. Is there anything to be done about this?
There is. There are very important things we need to be doing. And it's important that we all keep in mind that those of us who are working with this on a daily basis and realize how bad it is, we haven't given up hope. We certainly believe that we're going to have coral reefs in the future if we do our part and allow the reefs to do theirs. So what are some of those things? The first is we need to be dealing with climate change. The Paris Agreement calls for keeping temperature increase around the globe, the global average, to well below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial conditions. And it has a second target that it calls for efforts to keep long-term temperatures at 1.5 degrees or below. Well, actually, for coral reefs, 1.5 is what we need. Anything above 1.5 is going to be bad for reefs. Anything above 2 is going to be catastrophic. And so we need to be working on dealing with climate change by reducing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You'll notice I didn't say reducing emissions, because it's not about just removing emissions. We also need to be thinking about negative emissions. How can we pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and clean up that part of our air that has been polluted, but we just can't see? The next thing, though, is we need to be reducing local stress. Problems like land-based sources of pollution, you know, runoff of fertilizer, nutrients, runoff of sediments from poor land use. You know, these are all problems that have been facing coral reefs and continue to. Overfishing or destructive practices of fishing, habitat destruction, you know, these are all really important things. And by reducing those stressors, it helps the reefs have a better chance of recovering. But now we need to be looking at some much more dramatic things. And in Australia, they're even looking at installing large fans that, big propellers that will draw cooler water up and pump it onto the reefs at the time that the bleaching is going on. There also is talk about ships that will spray seawater into the air, producing low-level boundary, marine boundary layer clouds that can shade and cool the waters. So, you know, there are some actual direct actions we can take. The other one is the work that's going on coral restoration. The coral nurseries have been a great advance, especially for growing fast-growing corals, and there's some wonderful efforts underway. But one of the problems there is you never restore a habitat until you've removed the problem that killed things in the first place. And here with climate change, we're continuing to see that rising temperature. So there are teams that are working on selectively breeding corals that are better able to survive the future and using those as a part of these restoration activities. So there's a whole suite of things that are either underway or being contemplated that we need to be taking care of. But if we don't deal with that first one, if we don't address climate change, we shouldn't even bother with the rest.
And I would add one more thing. Let's not build a great big coal shipping port right near the reef as well, but we'll see whether that ever happens. How do our listeners find Coral Reef Watch, and how do they use it when they get there?
So Coral Reef Watch is easy to find online. It's coralreefwatch.noaa.gov. You can also find us at Coral Reef Watch on Twitter and Facebook. Most of our tools and materials are available on the website. You can go in there, and there are maps showing where the heat stress is potentially causing coral bleaching all around the world right now. There are detailed maps and tools with things like the gauges, like you see a fire danger when you go into a forest. We have bleaching danger gauges on the pages for different places. So whether you want to know about the Great Barrier Reef, whether you want to know about Florida, whether you want to know about Hawaii, you know, all of these are places that you can look at and see what the current heat stress levels are and what the climate models tell us are likely to be seeing in the about 4 months out. We can predict about 4 months ahead with pretty good accuracy. And so they can go through and do all of that. And if they live near a reef or have a reef they're particularly concerned about, they can sign up for email alerts, and they'll be alerted only when there's a change in the heat stress level on those reefs. And so we do this for all around the world. It's not just the U.S. So, you know, whether we're talking about, you know, Sri Lanka, Kiribati, or Florida, it's all the same.
One last thing. You just returned from Puerto Rico after yet another island-wide blackout, and that was the scene of a super hurricane, which we think climate change added to it. What is your sense of the feeling that people had there when the lights went out again?
Oh, again? They've become rather resigned to it. There was, in fact, just an outage that occurred last week that took out the power to 850 or 900,000 people in San Juan. This was bigger. It took out the power grid for the entire island. You're dealing with a Commonwealth of the U.S. that is not treated as though it's part of the U.S. It also is an area that is very poor and has very limited infrastructure by U.S. standards. So they don't have a very robust power grid, and so when power goes out, it's a lot tougher. So there's a lot that needs to be done there, and they know it. But they're also dealing with big, major economic problems that preceded the hurricane. So they're working through it, and they're trying to get help from people to deal with things, while at the same time they're still, you know, there are people without roofs and people who have not had power since Hurricane Maria came through last year, and we're just a little more than a month away from the beginning of the next hurricane season.
Well, to the people of Puerto Rico, we love you, and really we have the responsibility that these storms have become so extreme, in my opinion, because of our longstanding greenhouse gas emissions. But really, we've been talking about coral throughout this, and especially I want to encourage people to go and visit Coral Reef Watch. Our guest, Dr. Mark Eakin, is the coordinator of NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. He's the author of the paper published April 18th, 2018, co-author, I should say, in the journal Nature, titled Global Warming Transforms Coral Reef Assemblages. There's a lot to it. I encourage you to go and look at it. The lead author is Professor Terry P. Hughes, and he is from the ARC Center of Excellence Coral Reef Studies in Australia. Find links to the science and this discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Mark, thank you so much for sharing your busy time with us.
Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to spend that time with you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In the science world, there's a growing awareness of the dangers of extremes. If rains increase a little or decrease a little, nature adjusts. A little hotter and we all get by, even as the normal base continues to warm as each decade passes. But extreme precipitation events are blowing in across the globe, while elsewhere droughts last longer, forest fires burn earlier, later, and then all year round. As our guest Eric Oliver told us, there is no global monitoring system for marine heat waves. Just this week, a bottlenose dolphin was spotted in what should have been the cold waters off Vancouver Island on Canada's west coast. That should never happen. We need a marine warning system for the subtropics, where most of us live, as provided now for the tropics by NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. All of us on land should be told what is happening in the seas, along with our weather forecasts. We need to see the maps. The public hardly knows it, but marine heat waves may be the next big thing.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
My listeners educate me, as do my guests. Feel free to write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. You can help the future. Please pass on this radio show through social media and wherever you travel on the Internet. And keep supporting your local nonprofit radio station. They keep this vital information beaming out. I'm Alex Smith. Join us again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Discrimination is only addressed by universities once it's actually challenged by people.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. SJP is Students for Justice in Palestine. JVP is Jewish Voice for Peace. And those are just two of about 50 organizations that Israel recently deemed prohibited from entering because of their activity in organizing on behalf of Palestinian rights. David, if these entry policies that you're laying out are overtly discriminatory, how have U.S. universities been able to keep their support of these study abroad programs? Certainly there have been efforts to challenge the programs because of these issues before, but how do they contend with this double standard policy at universities?
Well, it's an interesting question, actually. Generally speaking, universities are, as you probably know, fundamentally quite racist institutions in all kinds of ways. I don't think that's a secret. They tend to be discriminatory just by their very constitution. And it's really only historically when universities have been challenged, whether it's on the question of admissions to students of color or whether it's on the question of facilities for transgender students or whatever it may be, discrimination is only addressed by universities once it's actually challenged by people. And to date, there have been occasional attempts to challenge these programs, but not yet, as far as we're aware, a national campaign of the kind we're trying to organize that will draw attention to this. And I want to say, of course, that it's not only study abroad programs through which the universities support Israeli efforts to paint the state as an open liberal democracy. It's also through a whole gamut of institutional collaborations with Israeli academic institutions that include, for example, scientific collaborations on research, holding of conferences in collaboration with Israeli academics, and indeed sometimes with Israeli defense forces. And all these are instances of the university collaboration with Israel that hold up, and this is really the most important point, hold up Israel as an example of democracy, when in fact Israel is, as has been well established, an apartheid state that systematically discriminates against its Palestinian citizens, whether they are Muslim or Christian, and indeed discriminates also against other groups in the state who are immigrant or refugee. So universities have a long history of such collaborations and such collaboration with the Zionist effort to appear like a modern liberal state. And above all, we are launching this campaign in the year of the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, the Palestinian catastrophe, when something like 750,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from Israel. Because whereas, you know, we are protesting the fact that some of our students may completely arbitrarily be discriminated against if they make the attempt to join study abroad programs. The real scandal is not that. The real scandal is that the descendants of 750,000 Palestinians who were expelled with the Nakba, and many of whom have subsequently been expelled again from the West Bank or Gaza, are now unable to return themselves to what are effectively their homes. So, you know, that Israel racially profiles American students or faculty who seek to enter is one thing, but the fact that they are in fact maintaining a ban on the return of Palestinians to their historic homes is really the issue that we're trying to draw attention to.
That's the voice of David Lloyd. He's a member of USACBI, the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. He's also a professor at UC Riverside in Southern California. David, let's talk about this campaign. What is USACBI calling for? How are campaigners organizing around this?
Well, in the first place, what we are asking for people to do is to join us in pledging to boycott all such programs. People can go to our site, which is www.usacbi.org, and find a button on which they can sign up to pledge to boycott the programs. In the further reach of the campaign, what we want to do is bring pressure to bear on universities to end or suspend these campaigns until Israel complies with international law and human rights norms. And as your listeners probably know, this involves ending the occupation of the West Bank and the siege of Gaza. It involves honoring the right of refugees to return, to which this campaign is most apposite, and honoring the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel to have equal rights with Jewish citizens of Israel. So those three demands of the BDS movement are the ones that we would expect Israel to honor if, in fact, we are to participate again and study abroad there.
David, we know the reach and the influence that major Israel lobby groups have on U.S. campuses. I think you mentioned that before. How are academics and members of this campaign bracing or preparing for the blowback that will come because you're challenging the study abroad program?
Well, inevitably, as in the case of every effort to hold Israel accountable for its violation of international law and human rights, we expect them to conduct a campaign of lawfare against us. It's important to note that several of the people most closely involved with launching this campaign have already been targets of lawsuits of defamation and of attempts at sanction for their activity in this respect, and remain completely undaunted, because we know that it is our constitutionally protected right to engage in boycott and other forms of protest against injustice. And these lawfare campaigns that have been launched against, for example, American Studies Association, or efforts to close down courses, which I myself was the object of for a while ago at UC Riverside, where I teach, these efforts always fail because they're found to be without merit and in many cases to be frivolous. So we are expecting huge pressure in the form of legal efforts to prevent this from happening. We're also expecting, of course, a huge propaganda campaign and further efforts by Israeli institutions even to step up the study abroad programs that they already host. So all of this is completely predictable, I think, at this point, for anybody who has any experience of trying to work for Palestinian human rights. On the other hand, we also know that what has changed in the years since USACBI was founded, which you may know was in 2009, just in the wake of the Israeli assault on Gaza, the Castellet operation. In the nearly 10 years now since US ACBI was founded and other organizations also became more active in fighting for Palestinian human rights, the landscape has really changed. The landscape of civil society, which used to be almost entirely silent on the question of Palestine, now through campaigns of this nature, whether organizing in academic associations or raising the question of divestment from companies that do business that support the settlements on the West Bank, or whether it's the work of church organizations or Jewish Voice for Peace, et cetera, targeting Israeli injustices, the question of Palestine is now very high on people's agenda, and much more information is circulating about Israeli discrimination. One of the things about the targeting the study abroad programs, as I've argued in the past, is that it brings attention not only to the apartheid structure of the occupation itself and people ranging from Bishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa to former President Jimmy Carter have been quite willing to say that the regime that is in place in the occupied West Bank is tantamount to apartheid. What is less often admitted is that Israel itself, with something like 50 laws that openly discriminate against the Palestinian citizenry of Israel, is itself an apartheid state. And by drawing attention to the fact that Israel discriminates at its borders against certain categories to whom many of our students belong, is in a sense advancing the work of BDS by taking away, if you like, the screen behind which Israel hides its non-democratic practices, that screen which I've mentioned already, by which it claims to be a liberal democracy and indeed the only liberal democracy in the Middle East. So I think that the importance of this campaign is that we're moving from asking for divestment from companies that do business on the occupied West Bank to actually raising the question of what Israel itself is as a state.
David, finally, and you mentioned this before, but if you could give the information again about this campaign, how students, members of faculty, families of students or faculty can plug into this campaign and learn more about how people are mobilizing.
Well, the very first thing that people can do is go to our site. That's www.usacbi.org, www.usacbi.org, and pledge to boycott all such programs of study abroad in Israel until it complies with the demands of the BDS movement. Secondly, hopefully people will do more than that. Hopefully they will begin to inquire of their administrations whether they are running or cooperating with study abroad programs in Israel, demand them to explain why they are running programs which violate their own anti-discrimination and equal opportunity policies, and thirdly, demand that they shut down those programs until such times as the Israel complies with these basic demands for human rights for Palestine. I think those are kind of the minimal ways in which people can participate. Hopefully they will also get involved in other campaigns like divestment campaigns as well. And, you know, let me just note that this does not only affect students. This affects students, of course, but it also affects faculty, people who have been denied entry to Palestine on the basis of their identity or of their politics. Ironically, it also has affected university administrators. My favorite example is that of Donna Shalala, who was under President Clinton, U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services. And she went on a delegation when she was president of the University of Miami back in 2010. And she was detained at Ben-Gurion Airport on her way out because she got separated from the group of university presidents with whom she'd gone to investigate ways in which they could collaborate with Israeli academic institutions. And she was apparently subjected to humiliating personal questions about which she refused to speak on her return. So we're talking, in other words, about a system of arbitrary discrimination which can target someone who's a university president simply because her name is actually of Lebanese origin. So universities ought to be attending to programs like this, which are in direct violation of their anti-discrimination laws. And we hope that people at all levels of the university will begin to ask questions, not just students, but faculty and administration as well.
David Lloyd, you are a professor of English at the University of California at Riverside. Thank you so much for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you, Nora. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Norman Solomon, co-founder of the online activist group RootsAction.org, who assesses the Trump administration's recent missile strike in Syria in response to the alleged April 7th Syrian chemical weapons attack on civilians. Energy security strategist Jill Gordis, who discusses the concept of distributed energy that promotes the creation of decentralized redundant electricity systems, mostly powered by renewable energy. And Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works, who examines the decades-long effort by the Republican Party to raise the eligibility age and reduce benefits for recipients of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Two Reuters journalists in Myanmar are going to trial for violating the Southeast Asian nation's colonial-era Official Secrets Act. The reporters Chow Saw-U and Wa Lon had investigated the massacre of 10 Rohingya civilians by Myanmar soldiers in the village of In Din. The incident occurred in the midst of a violent crackdown against members of the Muslim Rohingya minority by soldiers and Buddhist villagers. During the violence, over 700,000 Rohingya fled across the border into Bangladesh. The reporters had uncovered two photographs of 10 victims kneeling with their hands tied behind their backs before being executed. They also discovered mass graves where the villagers were buried. Only hours before a judge ordered the reporters to be put on trial, the army announced four officers and three soldiers in the Myanmar army were sentenced to 10 years of hard labor for their roles in the massacre. Yet the reporters who were charged with violating the Official Secrets Act face a 14-year prison sentence. The ruling ordering the trial of the two Reuters journalists was criticized by members of the independent Myanmar Press Council, who insist that the judiciary is caving into pressure from the military, whose leaders are upset about the investigative reporters uncovering grave human rights crimes committed by the army. In the final days of the 2016 presidential election, swing voters were bombarded with online anti-Muslim ads funded by right-wing hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer. One of the ads warned that Syrian refugees have taken over America against the backdrop of an image of the Statue of Liberty covered in a burqa. Although the anti-Muslim ads did not support or oppose a specific candidate, they echoed Donald Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric during the 2016 campaign. The online ads seen on Google and Facebook were purchased by a little-known right-wing group called Secure America Now that has no paid employees or volunteers. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the group is funded by a handful of wealthy donors, including Mercer, Ronald Lauder, and executives linked with the consumer electronics store Best Buy. Bloomberg News concluded the ads were seen by millions of voters, and Facebook reportedly developed 12 different versions of the anti-Muslim ads to test which was the most popular and effective with impressionable swing voters. Neither the IRS nor the Federal Election Commission is expected to investigate the actions of Secure America Now, so it appears that the dark money outfit will continue to try to sway American elections without government sanction or scrutiny. Food stamps, officially known as SNAP, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, often serves as a bridge for low-wage workers during intermittent periods of unemployment. Food stamps assist 40 million Americans a month to avoid hunger by supplementing paychecks to purchase groceries. Many low-wage working parents endure irregular schedules, working nights and weekends, causing them to have difficulty finding childcare. When low-income workers, who often have very few basic benefits, get sick, they're penalized and lose wages. A new study by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities suggests SNAP recipients are usually only temporarily unemployed and quickly find new jobs. More than half of adult SNAP recipients will work sometime during any given month. The report's findings go against a common narrative that poor people use SNAP for long periods of time in lieu of working. But the Trump administration and House Republicans are working to fundamentally change the program by expanding work requirements and limiting eligibility through harsh asset tests. SNAP participants must already register for work and accept jobs if offered. The study found that work requirements are less effective at shifting people into work than offering voluntary job training. However, the current Congress is unlikely to fund the costs of such training programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of reports that the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad had launched a chemical weapons attack on the rebel-held town of Douma, killing more than 70 civilians, the U.S., France, and Britain responded with a joint missile strike against several purported Syrian chemical weapons facilities. The attack came days before inspectors of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons could reach the site to investigate claims of the chemical attack. The U.S. air assault was carried out without congressional authorization. While President Trump applauded the missile strike with a tweet that read, "Mission accomplished," Syrian President Assad and Russian President Vladimir Putin denounced the attack as an act of aggression against a sovereign state. Russia is Syria's most important military ally in the nation's seven-year civil war that has claimed more than 400,000 lives. Your reporter spoke with Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Here he assesses the U.S. media and Trump administration response to the alleged Syrian chemical weapons attack and the urgent need for diplomacy to end the brutal conflict in Syria.
What was accomplished was a lot of applause from mainline media in the United States, most of whom have been very negative towards President Trump, often for good reasons. But a lot of the critics, whether it's at MSNBC or the New York Times or Washington Post, who have been very down on a lot of things that Trump has done, really saluted. They applauded. They said how great it was that the president would take action in this military way, much pressure to do more. And that's something that unfortunately has become a sort of a repetition compulsion disorder by the mass media, to promote and push military action, usually not authorized by Congress, but egged on and pushed for by the mass media. And that was the case here. Other than that, what was accomplished was to keep the ball rolling for more killing in various directions in Syria. I don't think there's a case that can be made that sending missiles into Syria is going to reduce the killing. On the contrary, the more you put fuel on the fire and people suffer and die.
Norman, one of the major issues that really is not being addressed by the Trump administration, nor the Obama administration before it, was the slaughter of hundreds of thousands, upwards of more than 400,000 civilians have been killed in this war since 2011. It seems like the United States and much of the rest of the world is just standing aside and not taking action, except in this instance of alleged use of chemical weapons. Seems like we're losing sight of the bigger priority here.
Well, a lot of people in the United States sincerely want the United States to intervene. They feel you've got to do something. The question is what? And often the idea, oh, we've got to do something, is more about us than about the situation in reality. It's sort of self-therapy, so we'll feel better about it. We're not being inactive. The U.S. has been involved shipping weapons through the CIA to various groups, often terrorist groups, by the description of the State Department, end up with some of those weapons. Nobody can really keep a straight scorecard on these morphing groups, often jihadist groups in Syria, so-called opposition, rebel opposition. There was a phrase even coined a couple of years ago. I think, seriously, Scott, the moderate extremist was one description of some of the factions involved in trying to overthrow the Syrian government. And you know, to me, the clearest and most sensible and most humane position is to oppose all the killing from all directions. And I would condemn the Assad government. I would condemn the rebels who have been killing people. I would condemn Russia and the United States for sending in weapons and egging on and making more and more this of a proxy war with more and more slaughter. The pressure in the United States, though, is for the U.S. to up the ante. And after all, as U.S. citizens, or at least people who live inside the borders of the United States, we can't have a big effect on other governments, but theoretically, we have, in a democracy, effect on our own.
Norman, one thing that I think strikes the chords of many Americans' hearts and people across the world is seeing children particularly suffering with this alleged chemical attack. And then you have the response of our media, as you described, egging on a military response. We have inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW. Their mission is to go and inspect the site and see what was responsible for the deaths of these some 70 people in the village of Douma. What should have been the U.S. response here, if any, on the allegations that chemical weapons were used against important international treaties?
Well, even if you want to shoot, you first find out the facts. And it was really bass-ackwards, avowedly, and cheered on by the U.S. mass media, the White House, acknowledging, at least to some degree, acknowledging, well, we don't have the facts. We don't really know for sure what happened there. Was there a chemical weapons attack, which it looks like there probably was? Who perpetrated it? We don't know, but we'll fire in some missiles anyway. I mean, this is just absolutely backwards to the most sensible, elementary way that one would proceed, even if you thought that you would help the situation by sending missiles into the country. OPCW is an organization that is in sync with the history of inspectors and international groups dominated by the United States, very politicized. We are in a sea of propaganda. We're drowning in it. I'm not going to sign up on any side in this conflict except finding peace, and that would require regional diplomacy. We hardly ever hear regional diplomacy or any diplomacy talked about seriously. It's often, if mentioned at all, just in the context of window dressing to try to gain some sense of PR advantage or credibility before the U.S. goes ahead and does what it wants to do anyway. But there's no way in hell that there's going to be any solution in Syria without various countries in the region and beyond coming together and really sitting down at the conference table.
That was Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and author of several books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Find more news and analysis on the Syrian war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The concept of distributed energy, that is, energy systems that are small, redundant, and mostly powered by renewable energy, is slowly gaining ground as a response to weather disasters. Distributed energy can also improve resilience in responding to outages caused by climate disruption, as well as cyber and physical attacks targeting a nation's energy infrastructure. Joel Gordis, a Connecticut-based energy security strategist, has for many years been focused on the importance of designing energy systems that are resilient against such threats. He recently testified before the Connecticut Public Utilities Regulatory Authority about the issue. At that hearing, Gordis called on the state to incentivize electric utilities to decentralize the energy grid in exchange for healthy rates of return. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Gordis about the progress being made and the obstacles that remain to make distributed energy decentralized energy grids a reality across the U.S.
The problem is when there's a disaster or something, they concentrate on what the cause of that disaster was rather than looking at it as an all-hazards approach. In order to do that, you have to look at the following types of problems that can arise. First is a fuel supply interruption with cost escalation going with it. That's happened to us in the past over oil when we were much more dependent on the Middle East. Then there's the physical security of the generation, transmission, distribution, and control systems. And that includes, when I talk about physical security, all forms of natural disasters, including those from climate change. So climate change is just one type of disaster that can take place. Then there's foreign dependency and disruption of globalized supply chains for components and critical materials. For instance, every plant and every system has to have what are called step-up transformers. Most of these are manufactured overseas and are very large and very difficult to move. So you have the problem of foreign manufacture and the idea that the transport is very difficult. Then cyber threats. Well, this is one of the newest ones, but then again, it isn't. I've been talking about cyber threats since the 90s, and people thought I was a little bit crazy. In fact, the Siting Council here in Connecticut would not let me even use the word until two members intervened to force that to take place. Then there are combined or blended combinations of what I've just mentioned, all the above. For instance, there might be a physical attack accompanied by a cyber attack taking place at the same time. Last of all are what we call unintended consequences. For instance, adding complexity to an already tightly coupled complex system, which is our electric grid, something that takes place in a complex system is if something happens on one end of the grid, in certain instances, it can almost instantaneously have an effect on the other part of the grid due to this complexity. So those are the threats that we potentially face on energy security for the electric grid.
Joel Gordis, how do distributed energy resources address those threats?
Well, right now we have the centralized electric grid. And that's part of the problem, is everything is connected to everything else. And what we need to begin to start doing is decentralizing the electric grid. And that means very specific things. And I still hark back to the guru of decentralization, a fellow named Amory Lovins, who was the co-founder of the Rocky Mountain Institute. And in 1982, he and his then wife, L. Hunter Lovins, wrote a book called Brittle Power, and it was written for the Department of Defense, and then about a year later was released for the general public. This is what Amory and Hunter Lovins basically say, and I totally agree with this, that there should be many small units of supply and distribution. They should be geographically dispersed. They should be interconnected with many units, not dependent on just a few. They should be able to operate if they're in isolated modes. There should be some storage to provide a buffer, so failures tend to be gradual. Short links should be used at the distribution level and employ qualities of user controllability.
Is there any particular kind of energy that lends itself more than others to being used as distributed energy?
Well, basically, there should be many forms of energy. You should have more than one source in a good microgrid. And otherwise, you might have a large solar array. If you have wind capability, some wind, battery storage is what you definitely should have. And even fossil fuel types of small generators to take up any slack when you don't have the wind blowing or the sun isn't shining. So it takes into account a number of different fuels so that you have that capability of running under any circumstance.
Do you see any progress in moving toward distributed energy?
Connecticut has a limited program for what we call microgrids, but it's so limited and so underfunded that they're only doing about, from the beginning till now, and that's about over a four-year period, about seven different projects or so. Hopefully they're going to do more. The military, I think, is pointing the way, and what we learned from their experience can be adapted to the rest of the nation. Now, other states are also engaged in it to different levels, and I don't have a good fix on that, but I think some states may be far more ambitious than what's happening here. So that's something to look at and hopefully start to make an impact. I'm afraid it's going to take some sort of a cyber attack in conjunction with an ice storm or a blizzard to get people thinking of, geez, maybe we really should be doing the decentralization.
That was Joel Gordis, a Connecticut-based energy security strategist. Learn more about the concept of distributed energy systems by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Republican Speaker of the House Paul Ryan recently announced that he won't run for re-election in his Wisconsin home district this November, news that surprised many in Washington. But as he prepares to leave government in the face of a predicted Democratic takeover of the House in the November midterm election, Ryan and his GOP colleagues will be leaving an indelible legacy. The massive tax cut bill they voted for and President Trump signed into law, which disproportionately benefits the wealthiest Americans at a steep cost. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office projects that the cost of the Trump GOP tax cuts will cause the nation's annual budget deficit to top $1 trillion in 2020. The CBO also estimates that the U.S. debt will grow to more than $33 trillion in 2028, almost matching the U.S. gross domestic product, the highest level since World War II. After the tax cut bill passed last December, Speaker Ryan and other top Republican leaders, with no sense of irony, stated that the out-of-control deficit problem that they themselves had created should be addressed by slashing popular federal social safety net programs, including Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, under the guise of what they call entitlement reform. The House has already proposed strict work requirements for food stamp recipients, and those who receive Medicaid benefits in GOP-controlled states could also be subjected to work requirements. Your reporter spoke with Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, who examines the decades-long effort by the Republican Party to raise the eligibility age and reduce benefits for millions of Americans enrolled in the nation's federal social safety net programs.
Yeah, this is one of their oldest tricks. I'll tell you, deficits only matter when Democrats are in power or when the Republicans are coming for your wallet. So when they're talking about these deficits now, they're definitely coming to reach their hand into your pocket and steal your Social Security, steal your Medicare, steal your Medicaid. Look, it's not about deficit or debt. We are the richest nation in the world at the richest point in our history. This is just about political choices. It's a rationale that they're using. But Paul Ryan has fantasized about stealing seniors' money, pushing them into penury and an early grave since college. There's something deeply wrong with that. And yet he's proud of it. He's proud. He's proud that he supports policies that would destroy Meals on Wheels. He's proud that he would destroy Medicaid, the largest provider of long-term care in this country for a huge majority of Americans. He's proud that he would destroy Medicare, which does a far better job of restraining healthcare costs. So if you were actually caring about any sort of fiscal policies, you would be improving and expanding Medicare to cover everyone. But it's a lie. It's a lie that they care about it. They've never cared about it. They've only got one game. They can dress it up however they want, but it's to reach into our pockets, steal our money, and give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. It's their game. It's what they spent the entire first year trying to pass Trump Care, which just openly destroyed Medicaid, raided Medicare. And remember, they all voted for it. The Republicans are on record voting to raid hundreds of billions of dollars from Medicare, to destroy Medicaid, to cut $1.5 trillion out of Medicaid. When we defeated them on that, they just flipped it. They flipped it with their tax scam, but it's the same thing. Now they've just given our money to their criminal friends on Wall Street, and now they're coming to pick our pockets.
What do we know about what the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled House and Senate are planning to do regarding cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid? What's on the agenda?
They are politically savvy. That's why they pretend it's about deficits. They will dress it up. They're calling it work requirements. Don't be fooled, though. Don't buy the hype. These guys have one game, and it's to destroy systems that help people. That's what they do. So their work requirements, you know how you encourage work? You create jobs. That's what you do to encourage work. How is taking a person who's being treated for cancer, how is taking their medical, their ability to get that treatment for cancer, how is taking that away going to encourage them to work? It's not. It's obviously not. And that's what the work requirement would do. Don't be fooled. That's what they're talking about. See, these guys work for Wall Street. And Wall Street has an enormous amount of money to spend on a bunch of propagandists and spin masters and the like, who will dress up these policies in ways that they sound kind of appealing. Like, oh yeah, that's about encouraging work. It's not about encouraging work. It's not about encouraging work. If anything, it's a war on poor people. That's what it is. But they're not going to stop there. They hope that people will turn their head when they're only attacking their neighbor. But don't be fooled. They're coming for you next. It's what they always do. And remember, their goal, the crown jewel that they are trying to seize, is a $2.9 trillion held in trust for the American people. That is our Social Security trust fund. That is what they just cannot stand that they can't get their hands on. And that's what they're trying to do every single day.
That was Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump Republican Party plan to slash funding for the nation's social safety net programs by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis
of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on our newest affiliate, WBDY in Binghamton, New York, WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WRGU in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Good night, Kilu. To people in California's north, the name Kilu Niasha is familiar, like an aunt or another relative. To them, she was a voice of resistance, heard on public radio, mostly heard on her show called Freedom is a Constant Struggle. The former members of the Black Panther Party, she was Sister Kilu, a former member of the New Haven chapter. During the murder trial of Bobby Seale and Erica Huggins in 1970, Sister Kilu served as a legal assistant to attorney Charles Gary, who defended many top Panthers. During the trial, Kilu was known as Pat Galliard. After the party, she suffered from MS, multiple sclerosis, which left her paraplegic and in a wheelchair. Yet MS neither defined her nor stopped her. She became an immensely talented artist. She worked as a journalist, commentator, and a host of radio shows. She worked for years as a supporter of Hugo Yogi Pinnell, the late political prisoner. She was an endless and brilliant source of resistance to the system. She became a beloved and respected elder for young people in the Bay Area. We remember Kilu Niasha, mother, artist, commentator, revolutionary, and inspiration. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Jerusalem,
America as the new Israel. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hid. Nor do men light a lamp and put it under a bushel, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Jesus Christ, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:14-16. When he shall make us a praise and glory, that men shall say of succeeding plantations, the Lord make it like that of New England. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work we have undertaken, and to cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world. We shall open the mouths of enemies to speak evil of the ways of God in all professors for God's sake. John Withrop, Governor, Massachusetts Bay Colony, City Upon a Hill, 1630. I have been guided by the standard John Winthrop set before his shipments on the flagship Arbella 331 years ago, as they, too, faced the task of building a new government on a perilous frontier. We must always consider, he said, that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. Today, the eyes of all people are truly upon us, and our governments, in every branch, at every level, national, state, and local, must be as a city upon a hill, constructed and inhabited by men aware of their great trust and their great responsibilities. President-elect John F. Kennedy, 1961. I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I've ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds, living in harmony and peace. A city with free ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here. That's how I saw it and see it still. President Ronald Reagan, 1989. Americans know that our future is brighter and better than these troubled times. We still believe in the hope, the promise, and the dream of America. We still believe in that shining city on the hill. Presidential candidate Mitt Romney, 2012. Almost 400 years have passed since John Winthrop wrote the words, "We shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." Words that have come to define and bolster the myth known as American exceptionalism. And like any giant lie, this fiction is responsible for the massive bloodstains splattered across the canvas of American history. Centuries of Holocaust and enslavement, accompanied by centuries of the always in vogue reality of perpetual state-sanctioned terror, also known as the murder and mayhem of war. American leaders have been invoking this mythical city upon a hill since Winthrop paraphrased the Sermon on the Mount to justify the land grab about to take place, with its subsequent atrocities heaved upon the Pequot and Narragansett Indians. Brutal massacres often launched against non-combatants. Governor Winthrop even declared the colony a vacuum, concluding that the indigenous inhabitants had no legal right or standing to their land. It was as if the existent population simply did not exist, and soon that would be fact. Winthrop and all the latter-day propagandists envisioned America as Shangri-La, a mystical and harmonious place, almost supernatural, where liberty, justice, democracy, and peace, not to mention affordable electronics, were the guiding principles. Well, like any good fairy tale, this American rhetoric sounds good, even sounds great, but has no basis in reality. There's no Easter Bunny, no Santa Claus. And there's definitely no utopian city upon a hill protected by a special sky god who represents American exceptionalism over all nations and cultures. Just like with James Hilton's novel, Lost Horizon, once you put down the fictitious and make-believe fable, there's no Shangri-La hidden at the western end of the Kunlun Mountains. American mythology preaches that John Winthrop and his Puritan brothers left England in pursuit of religious tolerance and freedom. But in fact, Winthrop, the de facto father of American exceptionalism, was no proponent of religious tolerance or democracy in any way, shape, or form. If we should change from a mixed aristocracy to mere democracy, Winthrop wrote, we first should have no warrant in scripture for it, for there was no such government in Israel. A democracy is, among civil nations, accounted the meanest and worst of all forms of government. To allow it would be a manifest breach of the Fifth Commandment. You've been listening to an excerpt from Murder Incorporated by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. This is Dreaming of Empire, Book One. Pennsylvania, the trial of Charles Goldblum, reportedly for the premeditated murder of George Wilhelm, was a sensation. Goldblum, a young tax attorney and part-time law professor, was the son of a prominent rabbi, and it didn't take a soothsayer to see that the case, which garnered front pages of the city's newspapers, could make or break a career of anyone involved. That was its promise as well as its curse. For Goldblum, it was even worse. For it's one thing to be tried for a sensational murder. It's quite another to be tried and innocent. Don't take Goldblum's word for it, but consider the words of his prosecutor, Peter Dixon, and that of his trial judge, Judge Donald Ziegler. Dixon, writing in a sworn affidavit made years after trial, pronounced Goldblum not guilty of the Wilhelm murder, and called the trial a miscarriage of justice. Judge Ziegler wrote to the Pennsylvania Parole Board several times, concluding that if it were a bench trial instead of a jury trial, he would have acquitted Goldblum. Goldblum, known as Zeke by his friends, fell victim to one Clarence Miller, a man described as having the mentality of a child and a known confabulator, a rare word, the core of which is fable. Miller took 3 lie detector tests and failed every one of them. When Pittsburgh police arrived at the crime scene, they found Mr. Wilhelm bleeding from over a score of stab wounds. He looked up, and his last words were, Clarence Miller did that to me. In law, that's known as a dying declaration, one of the most credible forms of evidence. Charles Zeke Goldblum, convicted for the February 9, 1976 murder of Wilhelm, continues to fight for his freedom. For more information, contact www.freezeke.com. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Why would the U.S. and its allies launch attacks against Syria over the use of chemical weapons before international inspectors can investigate the claims? Can the sources of claims of chemical weapons attacks in Syria be trusted? Is there a pattern to the timing of the alleged chemical weapons attacks? Is it possible that financial investors within the U.S., France, and Britain may have had inside knowledge as to the successful outcome of the U.S.-led airstrikes? Might British Prime Minister Theresa May have been among those who personally profited from the attacks? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, we take a closer look at the US, UK, and French military assault on targets within Syria and the outcome of that operation. We'll first get an update from 21st Century Wire editor and journalist Vanessa Beely, who has been on the ground in Damascus for the past 5 weeks. We'll also get an analysis from Professor Michel Chosadovsky about revelations of a conflict of interest on the part of Prime Minister May, whose husband works for a huge financial firm heavily invested in military companies profiting from the recent airstrikes. On this week's program, Who Benefits from the Syrian Airstrikes? Conversations with Vanessa Beely and Michel Chosadovsky. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 20th, 2018. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The U.S. government responds to each exposure of its lies by concocting new ones. The chemical weapons charge followed directly after the collapse of the unsubstantiated British and U.S. claims that Russia carried out the attempted assassination on British soil of its former agent, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter, Yulia, using a nerve agent. Both Yulia and Sergei are now on their way to a full recovery despite having supposedly been poisoned with the most fatal military-grade agent in existence. Yesterday's report by the FBI and the UK's National Cybersecurity Center, advisory Russian state-sponsored cyber actors targeting network infrastructure devices, is no more credible. Like previous charges leveled by the intelligence agencies against Moscow, there is not a single piece of evidence contained in the document to back them up. That comes from the article, As Lies on Syrian Gas Attack Unravel, U.S. and U.K. Shift to Claims of Russian Cyber War, by Will Morrow, posted April 19th, originally appearing at World Socialist website. Hundreds of Palestinians were gunned down on Land Day and during demonstrations for the right to return. Netanyahu has the full support of the U.S., so there is no outrage and he will not pay for his crimes. Netanyahu has every reason to believe that the U.S. will protect him, as the U.S. has many times in the past. Nikki Haley is not going to hold up pictures of dead Palestinian children. Instead, she will shield Netanyahu from criticism and accuse his critics of being anti-Semitic. That comes from the article, "The Victims in Syria, Gaza, and Yemen, U.S. Outrage versus U.S. Crimes Against Humanity," by David William Pear, posted April 19th, originally appearing at the Greenville Post. Diaz-Canel is seen as a competent official, loyal to the system Fidel established. He appeared often on Cuban television, playing an increasingly important role in political affairs. Older generation freedom fighters greatly aged or passed. Diaz-Canel's ascension to power likely represents a combination of revolutionary continuity with changes he'll pursue. It'll be a while to see the course he intends to follow. That comes from the article, "Cuba Chooses a New President," by Stephen Lendman, posted April 19th. Russian embassy officials have not been able to meet Yulia Skripal, and the UK's Home Office rejected Victoria Skripal's visa application, quote, because it did not comply with the immigration rules, unquote. Theresa May and her government cannot survive an uncovering of their Novichok fraud. A UK election in response to the truth will not only bring down the government, it should give Jeremy Corbyn and his Labour Party a healthy majority. Given Corbyn's anti-establishment positions on many issues, including the Mideast, and his scepticism about this fraud, the British deep state will find that possibility unacceptable. A couple of Russian lives do not matter in this scenario. That comes from the article, "The Skripals have survived, but they are not safe. The Novichok fraud should bring down the UK government," by Karen Brothers, posted April 19th. Mounting evidence shows that both the Skripal and Syrian incidents were actually false flag provocations, likely carried out by or with the connivance of Western intelligence services. The target of both provocations was, without question, the Russian state and its president, Vladimir Putin. Of course, Syria has also long been on the hit list of Middle Eastern nations targeted for regime change by the U.S. neocons after 9/11, with Israel a key beneficiary. Numerous news sources are documenting the false flag nature of these incidents that will not be repeated here. Note, however, that it has been the British that have been whining the loudest in both cases, though if Theresa May and her cronies, along with Francis Macron, do succeed in starting a war with Russia, it will be the U.S. military that does the heavy lifting, the same as the U.S. did in World Wars I and II in Britain's epic geopolitical campaign to take down its greatest continental rival, Germany. That comes from the article, "The British are driving the West's war agenda, but why?" by Richard C. Cook, posted April 19th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The US, UK, and France launched airstrikes against three supposed chemical weapons facilities in Syria on April 14th. Interestingly, just before international inspectors from the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW, could have investigated the supposed chemical weapons attack 7 days previous that was used as a pretext for the Western military action. To get an overview of the situation 5 days after the airstrikes, we reached Vanessa Beely. She is an associate editor of 21st Century Wire and has been reporting on the ground in Syria for the past month.
We have this extraordinary situation where actually France, the UK, and the United States, with the help of Israel, conducted an unlawful criminal act of aggression against the sovereign nation of Syria, on the basis of what is effectively social media chatter from open sources, which effectively mean organizations like the White Helmets, who we know to be financed by the very same states who conducted this hostile act against Syria and its people. And that alongside a number of other embedded NGOs and organizations who have very clear funding links to those who have a vested interest in the regime change war inside Syria. So, you know, that's the first point to be made here. And those strikes were conducted just as the OPCW was literally on its way to Damascus, having been actually invited by the Syrian government and having had their visas expedited by the Syrian government. So the narrative that the Syrian government or even its Russian allies have been trying to prevent the OPCW's entry into the alleged chemical weapons site at Douma is ridiculous in the extreme. The OPCW, I believe, tried to go in yesterday. We heard that there were shots fired at the OPCW as they arrived in Douma. So having had a delay while they requested permission from the UN Security Council, there was a delay from the UN Security Council itself. And in fact, the OPCW, we've been told here, don't need that permission because they have a predated agreement with Syria that they can come to Syria at the invitation of the Syrian government and they can inspect any site to determine whether chemical weapons have been used. And so when the OPCW finally went into Douma today, shots were fired and they withdrew. I haven't seen any reports since then. I've been told that the shots were fired by terrorist groups in an area that is still under their occupation, which is close to the area of Yarmouk camp to the south of Damascus. And so, therefore, there is a strong suspicion here that not only are the members of the security, the UN Security Council, so the United States, France, and Britain, keen to prevent the OPCW investigation, but we're also seeing their assets on the ground reacting against the OPCW investigation. And, of course, this comes on the back of the Russian military investigation. Statements which were released through the Russian Ministry of Defense that Syrian Arab Red Crescent and UN agencies on the ground had said that there was no chemical weapon attack on the night in question, that in fact patients were being brought into the hospital suffering from respiratory problems, from smoke and dust, from a military campaign attack. We don't actually know whether it was as a result of from the Syrian Arab Army or from the terrorist groups. But certainly they were not complaining of any form of chemical weapon attack symptoms. And there are, of course, the two protagonists in the videos that were being put out claiming it was a chemical weapon attack who have given an interview saying exactly that, that this was not a chemical weapon attack. They were not treating the patients who were coming in for any form of chemical weapon attack. And then I believe in the last couple of days, a Russian journalist has actually located one of the children that was filmed in the alleged chemical weapon attack video being doused with water. And again, he has corroborated the story that this was not a chemical weapon attack. And a number of other, even mainstream journalists like Robert Fisk of The Independent, who's probably one of the most sort of acclaimed Middle East correspondents. He has basically reiterated the Russian position that this was not a chemical weapon attack, or that at least this narrative was questionable in the extreme. And a number of other mainstream media from various EU member states have come and pretty much come to the same conclusion. So it's very hard to sort of follow through the narrative that is now being proposed by corporate media in the West, that the victims of this chemical weapon attack somehow made it onto the buses with all the terrorist groups to be evacuated to Idlib and are now showing symptoms or remnants of the chemical weapon attack in Idlib. So to me, this appears to be sort of one of the most extraordinary, elaborate false flags that I think we've witnessed in Syria, and we've seen quite a few. Added to which, in the last few weeks, I've actually been into districts of Eastern Ghouta, and today to the IDP center in Al Haraja, in close to Eastern Ghouta.
How close?
And very close. I mean, this is an area where probably less than a kilometer. This is where people came to after they had evacuated from the various liberated areas of Eastern Ghouta during the military campaign, the Syrian government and the Russian reconciliation organizations on the ground opened the humanitarian corridors to allow civilians to be evacuated. And those who could not be reunited with family in Damascus city center went into the incredibly well organized, I have to say, internally displaced persons camps that were set up specifically to take these families in. And the one I visited today is housing around 20,000 people. I was absolutely flabbergasted. I mean, this is only, probably a couple of weeks after the full liberation. Children are back at school. The kitchens are running like a sort of, like clockwork to produce food for the 20,000 people. I watched cleaning materials, washing materials being handed out to civilians living in the camp. And I entered a lot of the rooms in the camp. I mean, you know, I have to say, what they've provided is quite extraordinary. I mean, these are like small houses. Most of them only have one family living in them, from what I can see. They're well taken care of. The children in the schools are ecstatic, is the best way I can describe it. I mean, it was actually very uplifting to go into the schoolrooms to talk to these children who didn't have really a proper education for the 5 or 6 years of the terrorist occupation, are now studying French history, maths, sciences, in really well-equipped schoolrooms with very dedicated teachers. Some of them were among those civilians who left Eastern Ghouta, and they've continued teaching those children. So this was actually sort of a very heartwarming experience to go into these camps and to speak to these people who are now actually being given food, being given medical treatment, and being given social security help from the Syrian government and, you know, from the Syrian Arab Red Crescent and from a number of civil society organizations. But what was interesting is talking to a number of people today from various districts of Eastern Ghouta, and I will be covering all of their testimony in a number of articles, but basically what they told me was that the White Helmets and a number of other organizations that they said were financed by foreign actors, predominantly actually by the British. The British was definitely number one at the top of the sort of intelligence operations inside Eastern Ghouta. And they described the fact that they would be told or they would be warned in their neighborhood about 2 days prior to an alleged chemical weapon attack. So they would be told to clear their buildings, to leave their houses on a particular day. And the one comment that was made by pretty much everybody that I spoke to was that they began to learn that those alleged chemical weapon attacks would always occur around a UN Security Council meeting or one of the peace talks, for example, in Astana, something that was pivotal or crucial to the Syrian conflict. They learned to expect an alleged chemical weapon attack because, you know, we've been told about the ones in August 2013, the Douma one recently, and the Khan Sheikhoun attack in 1 year ago, basically, in April 2017. But there's been a number, as we know, of relatively unreported or you know, other chemical attacks that have not received the same outrage. But I think if we map those chemical attacks out, you will see that they will coincide with the advancement of the Syrian Arab Army in a number of military campaigns, whether it is in East Aleppo or whether it's in Eastern Ghouta. And equally, if you map them out, they will probably coincide with, as the civilians have said, with UN Security Council resolutions or meetings, et cetera. And so this is coming from the civilians themselves, and they told me that they were warned in advance of a chemical weapon attack. They were told to evacuate the buildings concerned. They also told me that predominantly it is only children that are affected by these chemical weapon attacks. I mean, I met one civilian in Zamalka, one of the areas that was affected by the alleged chemical weapon attack in August 2013. He lost five children in that attack. But the story he told me was basically that they were somehow knocked out in their apartment, even though he explained to me that there was no evidence of an actual attack. But he and his children were knocked unconscious somehow. He to this day doesn't know how. He was on a first floor apartment with the windows had actually been broken, so there was air circulating. When he awoke from that loss of consciousness about 8 hours later, he and his wife were on their own in the Kafra Batna hospital, which was close to the Zamalka district where he was. Their five children had gone missing. It took him almost 36 hours to ascertain that three of his children were declared dead by the terrorists and by the White Helmets in Eastern Ghouta. When he went to the Erbin Center to find out what had happened to his children, they would not show him the bodies. They only showed him the photograph of three of the children. And to this day, the other two children are missing. Now, what he told me was that if this were a chemical weapon attack, he and two other civilians were the only ones affected in his building and in the surrounding area. So... If this were a chemical weapon attack, why were not all the civilians in that building affected, right? So, you know, I think what has happened with the liberation of Eastern Ghouta, and this is perhaps why we're seeing such a robust reaction from the NATO member states who are waging this dirty war in Syria, it is because I believe, having spent some time in Eastern Ghouta, that Eastern Ghouta is going to expose the intelligence PSYOP that has been running in Syria for the last 7 years. I think Eastern Ghouta was largely the center of this PSYOP. And of course, Eastern Ghouta had particular relevance to Israel because, and to Saudi Arabia, but particularly to Israel, because of course it had... The terrorist factions had taken over Damascus air defense systems in Eastern Ghouta, but it also meant that effectively they could hold the Syrian government to ransom with the daily shelling and mortar fire into civilian areas of Damascus city center. So it was a collective punishment of the Syrian civilians in Damascus, the six million or so, even more civilians there. So the end or the liberation of Eastern Ghouta is a huge victory for Syria against international terrorism. And it's a very big defeat with huge ramifications, I believe, for the U.S. coalition.
So you're suggesting, I mean, you said something I've never heard before, that East Ghouta, because I was thinking of the comparisons between Ghouta and Aleppo, and especially as you were talking about this convergence of you know, the same kind of pattern of, you know, there's, you know, some important event that's going to happen, UN Security Council. In the case of Aleppo, you're seeing that the Syrian Arab army is winning, and that's when you start to see a rash of Amnesty International and other human rights reports and other news suggesting, oh, my God, it's a terrible tragedy. We got to save the – think of the children. And it seems to be – a repeated pattern. But in this case, you're saying that East Ghouta seemed to be the center of this campaign where we're getting all this imagery showing all of the devastation. And then that, if that is the case, it's only a matter of time before that gets out there. You know, I mean...
Yeah. Well, and I think what... perhaps what the Syrian government and actually their Russian allies have learned from East Aleppo is to capitalize upon the evidence that is going to be exposed once these areas are liberated. And so what I have actually seen is a concerted Syrian investigation on the ground in eastern Ghouta. And I have to say they're doing a very, very efficient job. I mean, if right now, I would say that the U.S. administration, the U.K. Foreign Office, and its, you know, MI6 operatives, France and the GGSE and a number of EU member state intelligence agencies should be very worried right now, because from what I have seen in my relatively limited experience of going into Eastern Ghouta 3 or 4 times, I'm seeing the investigations that are being conducted are very in-depth, they're very organized, and they're very, very detailed. And they're going to be bringing very important information to the surface. And I think it's actually going to be pretty shocking. I mean, for example, even today in the IDP center, I met one guy who was a driver, an ambulance driver, at one of the hospitals that was frequented by the White Helmets. Now, you know, he gave me a fair amount of information about the White Helmets that even I had not been able to confirm. I had suspicions, but I'd not been able to confirm them. That a number of the White Helmet operatives were foreigners. Not all of them were Syrian, by all means. But exactly the same as many of the terrorist groups in Eastern Ghouta had a huge number of foreigners among them. We were told from Zamalka alone, or rather from, I think, around 4 or 5 districts of Eastern Ghouta, 280 British passports holders left in the buses to Idlib with the various terrorist groups. So as I said, you know, the information that is actually coming out of Eastern Ghouta is really quite revelatory. And what this ambulance driver told me, he said there were a number of foreigners among the White Helmets. He said the White Helmets were receiving around $500 a month, while the actual trained paramedics like himself, he was a paramedic and an ambulance driver, was only receiving around $100. And he said actually that wasn't consistent. He told me, as so many other people have told me, particularly in East Aleppo, that the White Helmets did nothing to help civilians. They were there predominantly to help the militants. One child, one 13-year-old boy that we met in the IDP camp today, who had lost a leg, he was on crutches. He told us that he came from an area called Hamulia. He'd been injured in a terrorist shelling of his neighborhood. He was picked up and taken to the White Helmet Center, and while he was unconscious, they simply removed his leg. They didn't even try to operate on him. And this, again, is a story that is consistent with what we were told by so many, particularly children, but adults also in East Aleppo, that if they were injured in any way, even likely, they would often lose their limb because they didn't want to have to treat them. So, you know, again, the number of testimonies that are coming to the surface here are going to basically unravel the propaganda constructs that have been created by particularly the United States and the UK and infiltrated and embedded into Syria to provide the narrative that facilitates, as we've seen, to terrifying effect recently, to facilitate an escalation of military conflict, or, you know, the pseudo-humanitarian context for intervention, also the calls for a no-fly zone, etc. And actually tonight, the military campaign to liberate the area to the south of Damascus, Yarmouk, which is known as the Palestinian camp. It's not a camp, it's a suburb of Damascus. That military campaign intensified tonight. So actually what we're seeing are ISIS factions firing rockets now into Damascus city center, a different area, into an area of Maidan, for example. And a number of buildings have actually been very badly damaged and destroyed this evening. And we're hearing again the jets overhead and the boom of artillery, because now they will basically push forward to get rid of ISIS and the remnants of other terrorist factions. I believe Nusra Front left Yarmouk in about 1 year ago, so now it's predominantly ISIS and a number of branch offs from ISIS and Al-Qaeda that are occupying Yarmouk camp.
You know, Vanessa, I think on behalf of my listeners, I mean, really appreciate the work you're doing and the fresh on-the-ground reporting that you're doing, even if there are some so-called independent news outlets that don't. So thank you so much for everything you've done. I know you're very tired, but I hope you can we can get some more updates in the not-too-distant future.
Sure, I would love to.
Okay, so we're speaking, that was Vanessa Beely, associate editor with 21st Century Wire, and she's speaking to us from Damascus. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Regardless of whether or not there actually was a chemical weapons attack in Douma on April 7th, and whether or not Syrian President Assad was responsible for such an incident, the actions taken by the alliance of the US, UK, and France were on extremely questionable legal ground. The United Nations Charter explicitly accords the United Nations Security Council with the responsibility of assessing threats to peace and the existence of aggression, and the responsibility to authorize the use of force in order to restore international peace and security, except in the instance of individual or collective self-defense of a member nation against aggression. Clearly, the April 14th airstrikes do not meet that standard. Consequently, the Russian Federation tabled a resolution on the same day calling on the UN Security Council to condemn the strikes by the US and its allies as aggression in violation of international law. The motion was defeated, not surprisingly, by the US, UK, and France, along with Côte d'Ivoire, Kuwait, the Netherlands, Poland, and Sweden. Four Security Council nations abstained, leaving only Russia, China, and Bolivia voting in favor. Syria's representative to the UN, Bashar Jafari, was particularly outspoken and scorned the three aggressor nations for not sharing their information about Syria's production of chemical weapons with the OPCW. There are conflicting accounts about the success of the strikes. The Pentagon claimed on April 14th that all 105 missiles hit their target, with 76 hitting a research and development center in Barzah, Damascus, 22 hitting a chemical weapons storage facility west of Homs, and 7 hitting a chemical weapons bunker nearby. The Russian Defense Ministry, on the other hand, claimed that the Syrian government was able to shoot down 71 of the 103 missiles launched by the U.S.-led bloc. Specifically, they shot down 4 out of 4 missiles aimed at the area of the Damascus International Airport, 12 out of 12 launched at Al-Dumair Military Airport, 18 out of 18 launched at Bali Military Airport, 12 out of 12 launched at Sherat Military Airport, 5 out of 9 launched at Mezeh Military Airport, 13 out of 16 launched at Homs Military Airport, and 7 out of 30 launched at targets in the areas of Barzah and Jarmani. It is worth noting that the Russian envoy to the OPCW claims that Russia has, quote unquote, irrefutable proof that the Douma chemical attack was a false flag orchestrated by British intelligence services with help from the U.S. designed to provide a pretext for the missile strike. In spite of President Trump's declaration of mission accomplished, even U.S. officials questioned the success of the mission, given their statements to Reuters that their storage of chemical weapons agents were scattered far beyond the sites in question. With the Syrian government continuing to make gains against the rebel-held areas and the chemical weapons provocation questioned as a motive, one wonders what the actual point of this mission might have been. Prime Minister May approved of the decision to participate in airstrikes against what the US-UK-France alliance deemed to be chemical weapons facilities in Syria, without a formal vote in the House of Commons and without UN sanction. It turns out that the Prime Minister's husband, Philip May, happens to work for the investment firm Capital Group, which happens to be the single largest shareholder in the arms manufacturer BAE Systems, which built the so-called Storm Shadow missiles, eight of which were reportedly fired by UK forces at targets in Syria alleged by the Western Alliance to be chemical weapons facilities. According to figures available as of March 31, 2018, 1 week before the chemical weapons attack was supposed to have occurred, Capital Group's holdings in BAE stood at 360,000 shares, an increase of 11% over the previous quarter. Philip May's firm also is the second largest shareholder in the U.S. military arms firm Lockheed Martin. Both BAE Systems and Lockheed Martin saw their stock prices soar in the wake of the Syria airstrikes. Given that Philip May is reportedly an informal advisor to the Prime Minister, does his involvement in Capital Group constitute a conflict of interest in this or other instances of aggression, even when the use of such force may be legitimate? Are the other NATO powers similarly compromised in their use of force? To discuss these questions, we're joined once again by Professor Michel Chossadovsky. Michel Chossadovsky is Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Ottawa, the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, editor of globalresearch.ca, and author of more than 1,000 articles, scholarly publications, and chapters in books. He's also the author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty in the New World Order, first published in 1997 and updated in 2003, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. Professor Chossadovsky, it's great to have you back on the program.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program. As we say, war is good for business, but speculating on particular outcomes, when you know what will be the outcome, is a multi-million-dollar endeavor. The issue is, if you really want to make money on the stocks of Lockheed Martin and British Aerospace, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, General Dynamics, in other words, the large defense contractors, you have to not only have inside information on the conduct and the timing of that military operation, but you also have to know what is the likely outcome. And the likely outcome was actually known to a limited number of people in the United States, France, and Britain. And they knew the outcome because they knew that the Russians would not activate their air defense system, the S-400. Why did they know that? Because prior to the conduct of this operation, they had actually negotiated with the Russians. They had said, we will not attack any of your facilities. These are predetermined targets, and the Russians agreed on the predetermined targets. In other words, the whole thing was staged. It was not really a military attack, a bona fide military attack where the defensive capabilities of the S-400 were deployed. And consequently, because of that, they knew that none of their high-tech jet fighters would actually be knocked out of the sky by the S-400. They knew that in advance. Now, if you don't know that in advance, you can bet and say, well, you know, if they knock them out of the sky, then the stocks of Lockheed Martin will literally plunge, okay? That didn't happen. But the normal speculator who didn't have that advanced information would place his bets and say, well, I think the Russians are going to actually respond, which they didn't. And I think everybody, you know, people who read newspapers and reports and so on said, well, this is very dangerous. The United States is going to come in. They're going to bomb Syria. Then the Russians are going to knock them out of the sky with their S-400. Then it's escalation. And then Lockheed Martin stocks might plunge because they've, literally, they've, you know, they they lose face because their aircrafts have been knocked down by the Russian air defense system.
Could you speak to that issue of foreknowledge? Because, I mean, I'm looking at the stock indications. We see the stock going up after April 16th. What evidence do we have that there were certain people who had that foreknowledge? Where does that foreknowledge manifest itself?
Well, that foreknowledge manifests itself in the office of Theresa May and her husband, Philip May, and in the office of President Macron, and of course, the main protagonists, it's the Defense Secretary, the White House, etc., the National Security Advisor. There are quite a number of people who know what's going to happen. Okay, there are quite a number of people. Some of them are advisors. Of course, all this top secret, but admittedly, if Theresa May talks to her husband, who runs one of the largest, financial investment outfits with stocks and so on and so forth. Well, her husband, what's he going to do? He's going to, because that's the whole basis of speculative trade. You bet on an outcome. And I haven't investigated the matter, but essentially you bet on the fact that the overall index of defense contractors on the stock market is going to go up. Okay, in other words, that those stocks are going to go up, so you bet on an upward movement. And if you're using option trade, then we're talking about put and ask. The put option is when you're betting on the fact that the whole thing is going to collapse. Okay, so some people bet on the collapse of the Dow Jones. It's a put option. And if it's an ask option, well, they're betting on the fact that it's going up. Now, how do you make money on those kinds of operations? It's only if you know what the outcome is going to be. And there's an issue of timing and so on. But in this particular case, the outcome of that attack was known in advance, that the Russians would not respond. Nobody else knew that. Well, there were a fair number of people involved in decision-making, but nobody else. Now, that information was, of course, crucial to the speculators, to the investment, to the financial institutions, which may have received that information. And I would suspect, of course, the outfit of the husband of the Prime Minister of Great Britain had that information. I would suspect that Lockheed Martin also had that because President Macron was a former employee of Lockheed Martin. And, of course, the Trump family and their links to Wall Street, the people there, obviously had that kind of information to a lesser or greater extent. Certainly Trump had it, and his cronies would certainly have bet it on the results. He said, oh, it's safe, go ahead. Bet on an upward movement of the stocks of Lockheed Martin and Boeing and so on, because we're going to come out successfully in that operation, and then none of our military capabilities are going to be attacked by the Russian S-400s. Well, they don't even need to explain that; they just say, "Go ahead and bet."
Okay, I just want to stop you right there because I think some of our listeners are familiar with the speculative trading that was going on days in advance of the 9/11 attacks, which on United and American Airlines stock, people who would suggest foreknowledge that these attacks were going to happen, based on the unusual number of put and call options. Do we have any indications yet of unusual trading activity in advance of this military exercise, or is that something we're still investigating?
Well, that's something that has to be looked in very carefully. There's data on option trading. I think what we can reasonably say at this stage is that this is not strictly a conflict of interest regarding Theresa May and her husband. It's far more serious. In this particular case, the company of which he is a senior executive has, it's a massive investment firm, both in Britain and the United States, and it owns something of the order of 10% of Lockheed Martin. Some say it's 7%, but other estimates say up to 10%. And it also owns it owns that on behalf of customers as well. But nonetheless, it's a bonanza for the May family, and it means that the British Prime Minister has fed information to her husband, which enables personal enrichment by that specific family. And the same thing goes for the Trump family. Now, I don't think that this particular incident is, I don't think that this process of corruption and fraud is limited to a single military event. They've been doing it all along. In other words, since Theresa May became prime minister, her husband is receiving foreknowledge of various statements that she's going to make, which will have impact on money markets, including Brexit, of course. So every time Theresa May opens her mouth and says, oh, Brexit, this, that, and the other, well, her husband already has foreknowledge of that and can speculate on what happens at the level of the stock markets. It's a form of enrichment which is, first of all, leads to tremendous wealth because you can use options, and it is directly the result of the complicity of heads of state and heads of government with powerful financial institutions. In this particular case, we have a financial family in Downing Street with Theresa and Philip May, and of course we have a tycoon, a real estate tycoon with links to Wall Street, who's in the White House and who does exactly the same, and whose cronies make billions of dollars simply on the basis of receiving foreknowledge of public statements which the president or his cronies will make. So that is the nature of this. Now, let's put the Theresa May issue into perspective. Theresa May is a liar regarding. Well, she's a serial liar because she's lied on the Skripal affair, the so-called nerve agent saga. She's lied with regard to the chemical weapons attack in Douma, making statements which were undocumented, with a view to actually launching that attack on Friday evening after the closure of the stock markets. And she's third. She is a fraud. Well, she's a war criminal as well because people get killed as a result of her actions. So there you have a liar, a war criminal, and a financial fraud combined. And I think I was born in Wales and I'm British, and I don't recall any previous head of government, prime minister, who had that kind of triangular denomination of being a war criminal, a liar, and a fraud. Well, she is all three. And I would say that under normal conditions, that government should topple, should fall.
do you see this government being brought down? Because I don't see much messaging about this coming from the opposition benches.
I don't see it happening. I don't see it happening because despite the fact that Robert Fisk's article was published in The Independent and there were several testimonies of what happened in Duma, all of that now has been sort of squashed away, and the mainstream media is coming out with lies and lies and fabrications. And as I would say, and that's very important, when the lie becomes the truth, there's no moving backwards. That is the nature of the crisis that we're living through at this moment.
I want to try.
It's a systematic lies, and these are actually transformed into truth by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so on. And people are misinformed as to what is going on. The independent media is, of course, threatened as well. But I think that is a fundamental issue. Now, look what's happening to the anti-war movement. The anti-war movement in Britain is not necessarily bringing out the lies and the financial killings issue. They are, in fact, taking on a position which is pretty ambiguous. And then you have people like Tariq Ali, who actually is calling for regime change in Syria.
Yeah. Could I?
And Tariq Ali happens to be one of the protagonists of the anti-war movement in Great Britain.
Could I get, just keeping the focus on the financial incentives behind war, I'm just wanting to try to help our listeners understand the dimensions of this, because how this incident involving the maze is different from a lot of the messaging we've seen over the years about the military-industrial complex and how defense contractors make money from war. You know, Dick Cheney's Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root, the Bushes and the Carlyle Group, that, you know, you do have this kind of convergence between the economic, these major multinationals and who create this incentive for going to war, and the politicians that they, you know, lobby for, finance, what have you. You know, that creates this overall incentive for the utilizing military force and militarism. And I'm wondering if the incidents that you're referring to with regard to May and Capital Group, if you could help clarify that difference.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, what we are generally focusing on is how politicians are being lobbied, you know, how the military-industrial complex in the United States acts as a lobby group and co-opts politicians, okay, one after the other. And they are essentially doing that to ensure that Lockheed Martin, Boeing, et al. Will receive multi-billion-dollar contracts from the Department of Defense, from the Pentagon. And of course, the $1.3 or $1.2 trillion nuclear weapons program, that's all lobbying, and that's war. War is good for business as far as the so-called defense contractors are concerned. That's happening, and that is of a specific nature and different to what we've just discussed, because here we are dealing with the selling of foreknowledge from politicians to financiers, so that, in other words, you have inside information that something's going to happen, and you slip that on to your broker on Wall Street, and then they speculate on the outcomes. And that is something which is quite routine. Mm-hmm. For instance, take Bloomberg. Well, Bloomberg is a news agency, but it's also an investor on Wall Street. So they come up with news reports. Inevitably, and I don't wish to criticize them, inevitably they have foreknowledge of what they're going to publish as far as reporting on particular economic events. And the same thing is true for the New York Times. But then at the same time, they're investing in Wall Street based on foreknowledge of news items, which uh, which for which many people have foreknowledge. I think of the various monthly indicators of employment and so on that we know about. But here we're dealing with something. We're dealing with a level of corruption which is beyond the lobby type of relationship that politicians have to defense contractors. Here we're dealing with the relationship between the head of government, Theresa May, and one of the most powerful financial groups on planet Earth, which can speculate based on foreknowledge of what Mrs. May is going to say and what Mrs. May is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the outcome there's the outcome of those statements as well. I mean, it's not, as I mentioned earlier, it's not simply the foreknowledge of foreknowledge regarding an attack on Syria, but it is also the foreknowledge of the outcome of that attack. Will it lead to escalation? Will it lead to Russian blowing off aircraft in the skies of the Eastern Mediterranean, etc.?
Yeah. Well, I think just an important distinction to make is that you do lay out a very important case about the possibility of capitalizing on this sort of information, but we don't really have as yet, at least as far as I'm aware, any documentation of unusual trading activities stemming from such speculative or insider knowledge. And so I guess what you're suggesting is that's something we really need to watch out for in the days ahead so that we can basically cement the case that this sort of thing is going on. And that, one would hope, would lead to some sort of repeal of this prime minister and the larger agenda.
Well, I think that, of course, the research has to be undertaken. I recall, because that was a theme of your program a couple of weeks ago regarding the legacy of Michael Rupert. Well, Michael Rupert actually took the trouble of looking at these transactions, options trades on those companies of the airlines, okay, United Airlines, and came to the conclusion that there was some very unusual financial transactions which preceded the 9/11. And as a result of 9/11, of course, they reaped billions and billions of dollars of revenue. And that, of course, that indicated that some people knew that 9/11 was going to happen, and they speculated on the results. And the result of those investigations are impeccable. Now, I would suspect that what we need now is that the trading in defense stocks should be the object of some investigation, both in terms of options, but also in terms of actual transactions, movements. I noticed, of course, that on the Friday, Lockheed Martin's value of the stock had declined, not by very much, but was on the downward movement. It was about 0.25%, I think, but it was in the red. And then, of course, you have the weekend, and then it shoots up on Monday morning. And typically, those kinds of speculative ops are best. I mean, I'm talking about actually the airstrike. The airstrike was timed with Wall Street. It took place after the closure of financial markets worldwide. And then, of course, when financial markets open up on Monday morning, then you have a movement in stock values.
Well, I think we're going to leave it there. But thanks so much once again for your thoughts, Professor Chasudovsky.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
We've been speaking with Michel Chasudovsky. He is the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization and editor of globalresearch.ca. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.